This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Everybody, this is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Moreno. Happy Monday. I hope you had a nice weekend. I know for some of you it still feels like Sunday night, but Monday it is. You got a whole new week ahead of you, and this is a five-day work week, ladies and gentlemen. Enjoy it. Make the most of it. Good luck with it. So there are a couple of ways. We got an action-packed show for you. I'll tell you about it in just a minute. But there are a couple of ways to handle being a policymaker or a legislator or a political leader in this day and age. So it's no secret that this country is facing some real problems. A lot of families can't even make ends meet. A lot of families are struggling with things like the cost of health care, the cost of a college education, even sometimes just putting food on the table and filling the gas tank. You have tens of thousands of Americans every year dying of drug overdoses. You have all sorts of people being shot. Five shootings in New York on Friday alone. Seven people shot in one day. You have a budget deficit that only seems to grow. A budget debt that is now almost too large to comprehend. We have very real problems with things like climate change. We have problems with terrorism. We have problems with illegal immigration. We have problems with affordability, just being able to afford to live in the community that you're in. And yet, rather than make a serious effort to tackle any of those problems or any of a thousand other problems that are happening in this country, in this city, in this state, apparently, the thing to do if you're a political leader these days is just rename stuff. Just rename stuff. Eric Adams, in a press conference on Friday, pledged that if he's elected mayor, he will push for the rechristening of various New York City streets and buildings named after slave owners, declaring that the Big Apple should move forward and honor real heroes. Now, he did this Friday as he unveiled a portrait of Ida Wells at Brooklyn Borough Hall. Now, Ida Wells really was an American heroine, an early pioneer in civil rights, somebody that risked being lynched to report on the atrocities of what was happening in the South in the 1800s. And she was a co-founder of the National Advancement for the Association of Colored People. She really is somebody worth celebrating. And I think it's great that he put up a portrait of Ida Wells in Borough Hall. Not sure why it took 8 years of his borough presidency. Not sure why it couldn't have been done earlier, but it's great. Better late than never. So I'm all for celebrating people, especially minorities, people that might have been ignored through different parts of American history. But for heaven's sake, my problem with going on this renaming binge of renaming streets all over New York is that it gives the illusion that you're actually doing something. Now, Eric Adams, who's got, can we all agree that if he's elected mayor, he's got a lot on his plate, right? We got people shooting each other like crazy. We have a $100 billion budget. We have a morale crisis in the NYPD. We have a crisis in the jail system. We have a homelessness crisis. We have an educational system which is totally out of control, both from educating children and anything resembling discipline or order in New York City schools. And there's still a pandemic going on, which he's going to have to deal with. And yet, his priority is apparently going to be to rename as many streets and buildings as possible. Quote, we have to clean up our history. We can't have children walking to school buildings that are named after slave owners. For starters, here's my issue with this. By renaming all these schools, let's say there was a school named for Thomas Jefferson or George Washington, by erasing that, by naming those schools for something else, doesn't it make it less likely that children who attend that school are going to actually learn the good and the bad that that person did? I mean, Thomas Jefferson, he might have been a slave owner, might have had that relationship with Sally Hemings, but he also wrote words in the Declaration of Independence that have been used for hundreds of years as a clarion call for freedom all over this country, all over the world. Now, I have my doubts about how much they're able to actually get done in terms of street renaming, because it's a pretty labor-intensive process for renaming these streets. And in Brooklyn alone, there are all sorts of streets, whole neighborhoods that are named for slave owners. You have Lefferts Boulevard, Lefferts Gardens. You have neighborhoods named after the Bedford-Stuyvesant, right? The Stuyvesant families and the Lefferts families both held slaves. So are we going to really rename Bedford-Stuyvesant? Are we really going to rename the Lefferts Boulevard subway station, change all those signs? And I'm not excusing the conduct of anyone that owns slaves. And if you want to weigh in on this, you can. 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. But what I'm saying is, my problem with stuff like this, and I'll tell you what's now being done at a national basis in just a second. My problem with stuff like this is the following. By having a big press conference, oh, we took George Washington's name off the school. We took Stuyvesant's name off the neighborhood. We took Lefferts' name off the street. By doing that, it gives the illusion to people that we're actually doing something. And we're not. And we're not. If racism is a problem in this country, if police misconduct or police treatment of communities of color is a problem in this city, then renaming a school that was named for George Washington or Thomas Jefferson or any other person that might have held slaves, it does nothing to actually solve the problem. It just gives the illusion that you're doing something when you're actually doing nothing. Now, lest you think that only New York politicos are capable of essentially fiddling while Rome is burning. Well, no, the national politicos are able to do just as well. A new congressional bill seeks to create a board. We're actually going to create a board to do this. Can you imagine? That's exactly what this kind of, if you were to ask me, if you were to stop me on the street, or if you were to wake me up in the middle of the afternoon, which is when I get my best sleep, in the middle of a deep sleep, and shake me awake and say, Frank, what does this country need? I would absolutely say, you know, what I think we could use is a little more bureaucracy. What we could use is one more board, one more committee. So now there's a bill sponsored by Elizabeth Warren that seeks to create a board to help rename more than 1,000 towns, lakes, streams, creeks, mountain peaks across the United States that, according to the legislation, is still named with racist slurs. The board would accept proposals from tribal nations, state and local governments, and the public on suggested name changes. You know what? Maybe I'm looking at this all wrong. Because if this is what the priority is for New York leaders, if this is what the priority is for national leaders, then I guess things in this country are pretty good, because clearly we've solved all the big problems. We can now go on to renaming mountains, streams, schools, and streets. I'll never forget about maybe about 30 years ago, they killed Superman. You remember that? Remember when Superman died in the comic? And I was at my dad's, and we were watching television, and this was the lead item on the news, that Superman had died, the character of Superman in the comic. Obviously, subsequently, he came back, but it was a big deal at the time. And my father said to my stepmother in front of me, he said, boy, I guess they, and he didn't say it ironically or sarcastically. He said it seriously. He said, I guess things are pretty good in, out there in the world if the number one item on the news is the death of Superman. And that is how I feel about this renaming binge that Eric Adams and Elizabeth Warren want to go on. Things must be pretty good if this is what you're going to spend your time and energy worrying about. Now, of course, things aren't that great. This is just politicians recognizing their impotence in their ability to actually solve substantive problems and instead throw a bone, throw some red meat to what they perceive to be their political base. This is ridiculous. This is absurd. There are things, look, there are all sorts of things named for people that I don't particularly care for. For instance, the FBI. We're going to be talking a little bit about the FBI in the 2 o'clock hour when we talk with Bill Burns about the what happened to TWA Flight 800, because, of course, Saturday was the 25th anniversary of the downing of that plane. And J. Edgar Hoover was a horrible person. He blackmailed leaders. He had an unauthorized hit squad. He was a horrible person. And yet the FBI building still has his name. I'm not running out there trying to change the name of the Hoover building, because I think it's important that we recognize J. Edgar Hoover's place in history, discuss it, debate it, learn about it, not erase it. I think this is wacko. Hey, at 1:30, I cannot be more excited to talk with Monsignor Stephen Rossetti. There is a tremendous uptick in exorcisms. Exorcisms are real. And Monsignor Rossetti is actually authorized by the Vatican to carry out exorcisms. And he and his team conduct about 20 exorcisms a week. And he thinks it's going to get worse before it gets better. He's got a new book out talking about his experience exorcising demons from people. So we're going to get into that. But for now, I'd like to hear your thoughts on Eric Adams, Elizabeth Warren. And I don't mean to single the two of them out. Those are just the most recent examples from the last 3 days. This renaming binge. Maybe you do think this is important. Maybe you are offended if your child has to go to a school that's named for George Washington or Thomas Jefferson, or has to walk down a street that's named for the Leffords family or the Stuyvesant family. If so, straighten me out. This is an open forum. I want to have a constructive dialogue. I don't need to just sit here and rant or have you say, oh, Frank, you're right about everything. No, I'd actually prefer you to point out the holes in my logic and explain to me why this should be a priority. 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. Mike is in the Bronx. Hello, Mike.
Hi. Did you know there was a second Declaration of Independence written by Thomas Jefferson?
A second one.
He wrote it to 10 friends the day or a couple days after to let them know that the sections that he was told to take out, he put them in these 10 copies, of one of which is down at the public library on 42nd Street. In it, he excoriates the part that was taken out. He excoriates the King of England
for slavery
against
slavery.
Slave.
That's right. Yeah, it's the portion begins. He has waged cruel war. If you've ever read if you've ever seen the play or seen the movie 1776, they spent a lot of time talking about the battle over slavery in the Declaration of Independence.
I would like to point out that we have so many things that are named after England, towns, monuments that are named after England. After we beat England, we never changed it. So we're still living with the English influence in this country. But, you know, nobody says anything about that because you have to get on with life.
Exactly, Mike. And it's even more so than what you're pointing out. Now, you're exactly right. But we actually have a whole bunch of things that are still named for when there was a heavy Dutch influence in our community.
Yes.
The neighborhood, the town that I live in, the borough that I live in, is still named for its Dutch origin. So you're right. I mean, it's just ridiculous. We could be renaming things every day from now until kingdom come. My question is, what does that actually accomplish? I think very little. Mike, thank you for the call. 800-848-9222. Talking with Monsignor Stephen Rossetti at 1:30. And we'll talk with William Burns about the TWA Flight 800 anniversary at 2:30. He believes we never got the true story. So we'll get into that in a big way. Mickey is in the Boogie Down Bronx. Hello, Mickey.
How you doing? Listen, what you're saying is very right, but I just want to put it into a frame that people don't seem to realize. White people get blamed for bringing slavery to this continent, which is a total falsehood. The American Indians practiced slavery from day one. Not every tribe, but most tribes. And all these people that want to change these names of our historical personage have to realize that at that point in time, probably 85% of the world had slaves, not just like the little percentage now you get in Africa and Asia where they still have slaves, but most of the world had slavery at that time. These people were not exceptional for their holding of slaves. They were pretty much in the status quo.
And it goes much back, even before this continent, the ancient Greeks, including in Athens, which everybody holds up as a model of civic virtue and democratic idealism, they had slaves in ancient Greece as well. Now, I don't think that excuses the brutal, and thank you for the call, Mickey. I don't think that in any way excuses the brutal realities of slavery, but I just don't see how renaming everything is going to erase the very real wounds of slavery in this country. If anything, I think it papers over American history. And don't get me wrong, I'm all for naming something for Ida Wiles. I'm all for putting up portraits of people that have been heroes to the minority community. And Eric Adams Friday mentioned maybe the Asian community as well. Great. Great. Let's do it. There's plenty of things to be named. There are parks. There are streets. There are schools. We have years. We have a lifetime worth of things to name. I just question how valuable it is to go ahead and rename things that are already there. And again, my real fear is that it'll give the illusion that things are, that we're actually solving a problem when we're not. We're not. We're window dressing. This is almost like putting a new coat of paint on the Titanic right as it's heading straight towards that iceberg. Oh, yeah, this'll fix things. Come on. 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. Very excited to talk with Monsignor Stephen Rossetti at 1:30 and to continue with your calls in mere moments. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.
It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
Do to me, leave my heart heavy, down in misery. Hey, all right, ow, hey, hey, ah!
James Brown. Ah. I got the feeling. See, I wouldn't mind naming something for James Brown, Mr. Please, 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 hardest working man in show business. Absolutely. But just, I don't want to rename the George Washington Bridge for James Brown. I mean, the James Brown Bridge, it doesn't have a good ring to it. 800-848-W, okay, it does have a good ring to it, but just let's keep the George Washington Bridge as it is. If we're going to build a new bridge, maybe we could call that the George Washington Bridge. I mean, the James Brown Bridge. All right, 800, and I'm being somewhat flippant. There are actually people who are more deserving of recognition than James Brown, who actually played a pretty important role in civil rights. For instance, Gloria Richardson passed away a couple of days ago at the age of 99. She's a civil rights leader you probably have never heard of. She organized and led desegregation marches and protests, and she was a real leader. She passed away on Thursday. She was the first person, most of her advocacy was in Maryland, and she was the first person to lead these movements, and as a woman, no less. And you see these photos of her standing up to National Guardsmen who are holding bayonets at her, and she shoves the bayonet away. I mean, this is a woman who had a lot of gumption. I would have no issue naming something for her. Just don't take away the George Washington Bridge. That's all I'm asking. Let's build anew. Let's add. 800-848-WABC. I will tell you, you remember Friday, I was a little concerned because Juliet and I were supposed to take photographs. And I came in, I was dressed, I think, pretty nicely. I had a suit and everything. And then we got the word at the last minute that the photographer couldn't make it in Friday morning and that they were going to reschedule these photographs, which I was actually pretty happy about because, one, that meant I got to go home and go to sleep. But two, I still had not taken off all my Cape May weight. As of Friday, I think I was about 7 pounds up from prior to Cape May. So now this gives me a little more time. I don't know when the photos are going to be rescheduled for, but I heard a rumor it might be Tuesday, but that's unconfirmed. But I hope it's not. I hope it's another couple of weeks from now so that I can take off this final 7 pounds. But taking your calls at 800-848-9222. We're going to talk with Monsignor Rossetti in just about 5 minutes. Frank is in Brooklyn. Frank, hello.
Hey, look, so I was just listening. You know, sometimes I agree with what you're saying on the show. I just had to call because, frankly, look, what you guys are saying about renaming things, there's not a single good reason why we should have statues up in our parks, why we should have military bases named after treasonous traitors who killed Americans for the sole purpose of upholding slavery. Another point, real quick, a lot of these statues that are put up, anyone listening can Google this, look up when these statues were put up. Mm-hmm. They were put up during the civil rights movement to intimidate black people. Can you imagine having a black kid as a black man walking past these statues every day?
Well, Frank, you're right on the Confederate statues front. And I spoke about that a little bit on Thursday morning. And you're right. But here in New York, as it stands now, we don't have any streets named for Confederate heroes.
Oh, sure. I'm not just talking about New York. I'm talking about across the country. A lot of people reject the renaming of Confederate.
Okay, well, look, the Confederate thing I get because, I don't know of a lot of other countries that celebrate the people that led a failed rebellion against them. Yeah. And that's pretty unusual. It's uniquely American. But, I mean, once we're talking about renaming streets in Brooklyn, Stuyvesant, Leffords, Washington, Jefferson, at some point, doesn't it just get to be a little bit too much?
I could agree with you there. It depends on who we're talking about. I'm talking more specifically as far as Confederate statues going, and there's a lot of pushback for that. You got to know.
There is. Absolutely. We saw that in Charlottesville. There was almost a riot over it. So, Frank, you know what I like about you? You strike me as a reasonable guy. It must be your name and something about the adjective in which people with that name end up speaking. They end up speaking quite frankly. But so, Frank, how about if we do what they used to call a grand bargain? How about we take down all the Confederate statues everywhere, and we leave up all the schools that are named for Lincoln, Jefferson, and Washington.
That sounds good to me.
There you go. See, that's the kind of grand bargaining that I think is missing in the public sector today. 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. Joe is in Jamaica. Hello, Joe.
Hey, Frank. Welcome back.
It's good to be back. Thank you.
You know, let's use that James Brown song and so forth and give you an idea about what I need here. I think, I'm worried that we may end up getting de Blasio 2.0, at the end of the election. Because with Adams. He doesn't want to refund the police. He doesn't want to increase the police. We talked about that. He wants to rename all this stuff. It's like, what's the point? You know, like you said, first of all, when you rename things, your name doesn't go away because you'll refer to things like formerly named whatever. Case in point, look at the bridge. It's called the Mario Cuomo Bridge, but many people still say it's, you know, the Tappan Zee Bridge. And so forth. So the name's not
right.
Really good. Right.
That's such a good point, Joe. In Staten Island, where we have the Korean War Veterans Parkway, everyone I know calls it the Richmond Parkway. I mean, the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel, which I take to work when I'm willing to spend the extra toll money. Not a single person I know calls. Do you know what it's called, Christian? The Brooklyn Battery Tunnel?
I have no idea.
So, okay. So,
know it as the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel.
Right.
Actually, I drove through it, and I forget the name of it.
So Christian drives through this tunnel all the time, almost every day, and he does not even know that it's called the Hugh L. Carey Tunnel. You know why? Because no one calls it the Hugh L. Carey Tunnel. Everybody calls it the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel. That's what's going to happen. If they rename Lefferts Gardens Malcolm X Gardens, it's still going to be called Lefferts Gardens. 800-848-WABC. Let me say hello to Gary in Inwood. Hello, Gary.
Good morning, Frank. The idea, in my opinion, that a street, a structure, a municipal building, a school, an airport, the names that they have weigh heavily on people's mind on a daily basis, and it's consuming and throws them into emotional frenzy, to me, is ridiculous. It has no basis, and it's just, to me, it's a perpetual victim scenario.
Gary, I think you're right, but I also think it's politicians trying to make an effort to look to the public like they're doing something, when in actuality they're doing nothing, personally. 800-848-WABC. Let's take one more call before we get to the Monsignor. Janet is in the East Village. Hello, Janet.
Oh, hi. Somebody beat me to it. I was also going to give my lighthearted objection to the renaming of the Tappan Zee Bridge. The Tappan Zee Bridge happens to be the perfectly named bridge. Now, I understand Andrew Cuomo wanting to put his father's name on something. It should be on something, I think, you know. But if you want to rename a bridge, how about the Throg's Neck Bridge, which no one can spell, no one can pronounce, no one knows where it is. That would be a good bridge to rename. But I'll explain why the Tappan Zee Bridge is the perfectly named bridge. You know why?
Why?
Not only because it's fun to say, Tappan Zee, you know, it has a kind of a rhyme.
Yeah, I tap on Z Bridge, so do you.
No. The Tappan Zee Bridge spans, pun wholly intended here, spans the history of the area. I'll explain why. You know the word Zee is the Dutch word for sea, right? Zuider Zee so it's Dutch. The word Tappan, I always assumed when I realized that Zee was Dutch, I assumed that Tappan also was Dutch. But no, it's not. It's Tappan are the native people of the area. The Tappan people were there, and I presume still are there, probably in very small numbers, obviously. So the bridge spans the history of the area. The Tappan people, the first people, Zee, the Dutch word for the second people who were here, and bridge, the English name for the English who took over from the Dutch without firing a shot, which I don't know. So one day you could explain it. You know history. How the British took over without firing a shot, I'll never know. Anyway, the Tappan Zee Bridge, besides being fun to say, Tappan Zee Bridge, and having a nice sort of rhythm, totally reflects the history of the area, and I think it should be kept. And as the gentleman who called before said, a lot of people are refusing to use the name. I noticed the reporters, the traffic reporters, will sometimes say the Maryam Cuomo Tappan Zee Bridge, or sometimes they'll just say Tappan Zee, or sometimes they'll just say Mario.
Janet,
Cuomo.
Good points, all. Good points, all. We're going to talk exorcism with Monsignor Rossetti in just a moment. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. Straight ahead. So many of you remember this as the main score in the film The Exorcist, a hit film back in 1973. The book by William Peter Blatty was a bestseller. The film was a monstrous success. And, you know, if you're like me, maybe you saw The Exorcist, maybe even some of its sequels, and you thought, okay, it's a good movie, a horror movie, scary at times, great acting. But you thought, okay, it's a movie. Well, lo and behold, the more research that I've done into exorcism, and the more openly that people who have participated in these exorcisms have been talking about them, the more you realize that the events depicted in The Exorcism aren't necessarily just pure fiction. There has been a surge in demonic possession all over the world, especially right here in this country. Now, I have always gotten the impression that, especially prior to the current pope and the previous pope, I've always gotten the impression that this wasn't something that the Vatican or the Catholic Church was too crazy about talking about openly. It does seem to me, as a very much a layman, that there has been a shift in the willingness to speak candidly about exorcism and demonic possession. Why are exorcisms on the rise? How does someone get possessed? Well, those are a few of my questions for Monsignor Stephen Rossetti. He is a Catholic priest. He's an author. His new book is Diary of an American Exorcist, Demons, Possession, and the Modern Day Battle Against Ancient Evil. He also happens to be an educator, a licensed psychologist, and the president and founder of the St. Michael Center for Spiritual Renewal. That's the problem with him, is he's not qualified enough. Monsignor, thank you so much for joining me on the radio. I know the hour can be kind of tough.
Frank, I'm glad to be with you.
Set the record straight for people that may not be following the story or may not know much about it. Exorcisms are indeed real, right?
Of course, you know, actually, you were talking about the movie The Exorcist in 1973. That's actually based on a real case. And you can read the notes from the Jesuit who did The Exorcist, The Exorcism. It's a real case. I was a 12-year-old boy and not a girl, and the movie was a girl. And there were some Hollywood things about it. But actually, the young boy got possessed by using a Ouija board for months. But many of the aspects of that movie were accurate.
Wow. Now, one of the more dramatic scenes is when they're conducting the exorcism itself. Sounds a little bit like this.
Creature of God. It burns in the name of the Father and of the Son and the Holy Spirit. By this sign of the Holy Cross of our Lord Jesus Christ, who lives and reigns with the Father and the Holy Spirit. Damien.
Oh, amen.
God, defender of the human race.
Oh. So, Monsignor, you've conducted these exorcisms. Your team has conducted many of these exorcisms. Mm-hmm. How realistic is that, the kind of prayers and the kind of ceremony that we see in that that attempted exorcism in the film from what you do in real life?
Well, there is a rite of exorcism, which the church has, of course, which exorcists are able to use. And it's essentially, you do cast out demons in the name of Jesus. Jesus cast out demons. When you read the New Testament, for those who actually don't believe in this sort of thing, actually, Jesus did a lot of exorcism, if you're honest, when you read the New Testament. And then Jesus said, and I give you this authority to the church to cast out demons in my name. And so we cast out demons in Jesus' name. So it's a prayer. And so that basic rite that you hear, although they didn't cite the whole rite, of course, but the basic notion was we cast you out in the name of Jesus Christ.
And how many exorcisms throughout the decades would you say that you've either conducted or been a participant in?
Well, I mean, we don't count them. I've been doing it for about 14 years, and we have a team, and we have a few priests to do this in our diocese, and we probably have about 15, 20 sessions a week.
Wow.
So we're busy.
And how does someone who is possessed, how does their physical appearance change? A lot of us that saw the movie saw Linda Blair's face become all sort of green and demon-like. And how is that in terms of comparison to reality?
Well, there's a whole range of cases. I mean, there are people, most of the people come to us are not fully possessed. They have some demonic influence. We call that demonic oppression or obsession. Some people are partially possessed. But for those who are fully possessed, some really bizarre things can happen. And I know people don't believe it, but all I can say is that's been our experience. And for example, one young man, his whole eyeball, both of them, turned completely black. I mean, they look like a bad movie. Or another, his eyes, when he's mad, what we call manifesting, they turn into serpent eyes. There was little these black dots for pupils, and the eyes were yellow. And all sorts of strange things can happen that are simply not explainable, you know, by human reason.
Now, in the film, you see the elder priest played by Max von Sydow. He's training Father Damien, a younger priest, in terms of how to conduct this. How does the training to be an exorcist go? How did your training go, and how do you train others to do this?
Well, there are places actually to learn. There's a place in Chicago, there's a place in Rome, but most of us learn by side-saddling with a senior exorcist, which I did. And that's the best way to learn. You participate in these and you learn with getting your hands dirty and getting in the room doing them with the senior exorcist.
We're talking with Monsignor Stephen Rossetti. He's a priest and an author whose latest book is Diary of an American Exorcist: Demons, Possession and the Modern Day Battle Against Ancient Evil. Now, has Pope Francis actually been on record as having performed exorcisms himself?
Well, he has actually personally spoken about Satan and that reality more than the previous post, which is kind of a surprise. I mean, I think people think of him as a liberal guy, but in fact, he is very clear about the reality of Satan, and I don't know if he's done them himself. But I know he's very clear about that. And also, interesting enough, I've been told that John Paul II used to do exorcisms back in Poland, and certainly did as the Holy Father. So it's part of our faith. I mean, some people say, well, you know, this is old stuff. We've grown beyond it. But I'm sorry to tell you, Jesus did exorcisms, and so does the Church. And while most people are not possessed, some are.
So there does appear to be, I mean, unless it's just a reflection of greater media coverage on this subject, it does appear that there has been an uptick in the number of exorcisms that have been conducted. Is that your experience? Are you doing more exorcisms these days than 14 years ago? And to what do you attribute that?
Yeah, certainly we are doing more. And the guys around the country who do this ministry all say the same thing. They're doing a lot more. It's hard to know why, but here's something I tell people. Look, I give you three easy steps of getting possessed, and I don't recommend you take them. Step number one, stop practicing the faith. Your basic protection against evil is Jesus, and so when you practice your faith and call on him, you're protected. So when you get rid of your faith, you're not protected. Number two, start committing serious sins. When you commit serious sins, you become more vulnerable, and you have these inner wounds, spiritual wounds. And then three, start doing occult stuff. You know, Ouija boards I mentioned, practicing magic, divination, tarot cards, all these sorts of things. That's just a clear invitation to Satan, whether you believe it or know it or not. And then people are doing these things. And I'm here to warn people. If you think doing magic's a fun thing, I've got something to tell you. You know, whether you try to do good or not, magic does not come from God. There's a Bible injunction against it, and you're inviting Satan into your life.
Could some of the exorcisms that you're seeing and some of your counterparts are seeing around the country and around the world, could some of this be due to psychological issues people are suffering, or maybe even mental illness?
Well, as you mentioned earlier, I'm a psychologist and has been practicing for 25 years. And so one of the first things I do is I need to discern the difference. And there are very real differences. And so we put them in psychotherapy. We put them on medications if necessary and see if that solves the problem. But then sometimes things happen which are just not psychological. It's more than that. You know, when you start praying over someone and you see this evil presence come forward, and there's a look on that person's face which no human being can imitate. It's just that look of rage and that look of evil, and out of the mouth comes, "You stupid priest," and they'd kill you if they could. That's an evil presence.
You describe one instance in the book of someone who was possessed and an upside down cross sort of appeared out of nowhere on her body.
Not uncommon. Satan mocks holy things, and of course, he mocks the cross of Jesus, and so he'll burn an upside down cross on someone, and it's like marking his territory, trying to say, "This person belongs to me," and he'll often say that. "She or he's mine." And so we say, "No, in the name of Jesus, we claim you for Christ our Savior." So, yeah, I mean, all these sorts of things happen. You can't say that's psychological. Or unexplained bruises or scratches. One person woke up who was possessed, and he had, it looked like a claw mark on his back, about 2 feet long, about five of them. And what it looked like was a beast. He raked his hand across his back, and that's exactly what happened. A demonic beast raked his hand across a man's back, and that's another sign of someone's possessed.
One of the things I learned in reading about your book, and I don't know why this surprised me, but and it shouldn't have, is that demons can actually text message.
Yeah.
How does that work?
More people have responded to that and don't believe it. Oh, you believe what you want. But I would say this. I've got them. I mean, I've got the text that we received. We shouldn't be that surprised. I mean, before cell phones, if a house was infested, for example, they'd turn the TVs on and off. They'd turn the lights on and off. They would mess with the temperature, all sorts of things in the house, banging, crashing. They can do physical things in the world. And so now their cell phones, they do send us texts, not too often. We've had three cases in which they've done that. But it's typical of the snarky demonic stuff. You know, you're weak, you're useless, there's no hope for you, she's mine, you know, and your efforts are futile. It's a typical demonic rant, frankly, we get.
Talking with Monsignor Stephen Rossetti, we're just scratching the surface here, but if you want to learn more about this, check out his book, Diary of an American Exorcist. So if you are possessed, can you be possessed by both a demon or Satan himself, or does Satan usually leave the business of possession to underlings?
Well, Satan, it's a huge hierarchy, so Satan's in charge of everything. So he's kind of like the overlord of everything. But does he himself act in the person sometimes? Yes, but it's rare. Lots of times the demons will say, they'll identify themselves as Lucifer or Satan, but they're not. But in a very once in 14 years, I've actually encountered Lucifer himself, and it was a pretty ugly event. Jesus, the power of Christ still cast him out.
So what you're saying is there certainly is a correlation between someone's piety and their likelihood of being possessed. If you are observing the sacraments and going to church every day and praying and having a strong relationship with Jesus, you're much less likely to be possessed than someone that's participating in a lot of the occult activities that you mentioned and committing all sorts of sins.
That's true, but there are cases in which someone actually is possessed through no fault of their own. For example, we had a young woman come to us, and it turns out her family had been doing abortions. And one of the things you learn in this ministry is that the teachings of the Catholic Church are true, from beginning to end. And they teach about the evil of abortion. And frankly, her family, not her, but her family was actually performing abortions. And she got possessed, and it was a tough case. It took us 5 years before she was liberated. It took 5 years, yeah. It was through no fault of her own. So there are cases like that.
William Friedkin, who directed The Exorcist, did an interview a few years ago with Michael Riedel on his radio show, in which he was talking about the Vatican's position on this. This is what William Friedkin said.
But before the last three popes, there were not too many people high in the church who were promoting this idea, because it isn't always successful.
No, when it goes wrong, it's...
Well, they don't want people to think, you know, there's guys walking around out there who did not have successful exorcisms, but that's the truth.
So let me ask you, Monsignor, about the both of those things. How often are exorcisms unsuccessful, and what exactly is the public position of the church on exorcisms these days?
Well, if you read the teachings of the church, it's always been part of our faith, that Jesus cast out Satan, and he gave that ministry to the church. Now, there was less emphasis on it, I would say, in the last 50 years until recently. I think that was the whole part of the Vatican II. Vatican II was, you know, which I support, but there was a downplaying of this, so it kind of went to mothballs for a while, I think. But I don't think it was because they were worried about unsuccessful exorcism. I just think that people were trying to emphasize good things, which is fine. I mean, emphasizing God and the holy angels, that sort of thing, which is good. But you can't ignore this. And there are people who are suffering. And frankly, the vast majority of people come to us are positively helped and they're freed. And that's a wonderful part of a ministry, to see someone get their lives back. But are there some that fail? Well, some take a long time. I mean, there are some that, you know, a couple of weeks, some a couple of months. We just had one finish up after 6 months, but it was a tough case. I had one, as you mentioned, 5 years. But some, they get better, but they just seem like they hang on, and we don't know why they hang on. Most of them don't, but they, you know, but it actually is not, it's not magic. It's a prayer to God to release the person from Satan. And God has his own plan, you know, and sometimes it's not what we would like, but we're patient. But people generally get better, even if they don't get fully free right away.
I saw there's a very nice quote on your book from our Archbishop, Cardinal Dolan. What has been the reaction to your book from the upper echelon of the Vatican and the hierarchy of the church?
Well, I haven't heard of anything. I mean, I think most of the – well, actually, the Holy Father said that every diocese – Pope Francis said every diocese in the United States should have an exorcist. And so he's the one that's leading the charge on this. And our archdiocese has been very supportive. So I think if they want it to be professionally done and in a way which is pastorally prudent. And that's always a challenge here, you know, because – you have people come to us who are really suffering, but also can, you know, have some real other kinds of problems too. And so we want to make sure that we do it in a way that's pastorally prudent, and we don't try to sensationalize this ministry. You know?
Sure. You've indicated that you think the problem with demonic possession could get worse before it gets better. Why do you think that might be the case?
Oh, I think no question about that. I mean, as people stop practicing their faith, and the number of people doing magic and calling themselves witches is I got to be kidding. You got to be kidding about that. People said, oh, we don't want to go through the Salem witch trials again. Well, this is not the Salem witch trial. In Salem, they accused these women, mostly some men, of being witches. And they said they weren't. Now people say, I am a witch. Mm. And they're trying to, they're doing witchcraft. I'm here to tell you that if you're doing witchcraft and magic, it doesn't come from the Lord. This is dangerous. And I don't care if you call yourself a good witch or not. You're using magic and you're calling on powers that you have no ability to control. And you might find that Satan becomes a part of your life in a way that you're going to be pretty terrified.
Final question, sir. Aside from staying away from things like witchcraft and the occult, are there any other practical tips that you can give to people on how they can avoid being possessed? Should they be washing their hands in holy water on a regular basis, or is there anything else that people can do?
Well, besides going to church and to Catholics, I tell them, go to confession. The most powerful exorcistic thing you can do is go to confession. And then go to Mass, of course, go to communion. Practice your faith, read the Bible, pray every day as a family, pray the rosary together. And yes, use sacramentals. We recommend you put crucifixes in your rooms, use holy water, holy statues. These are the traditional things which have kept people safe. And these are the things what the church offers to you as helps.
Monsignor Stephen Rossetti, author of the book Diary of an American Exorcist, a fascinating conversation. Thank you for the time.
Thank you, Frank.
If you want to comment on any portion of our discussion, you're welcome to give me a call, 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. Straight ahead. James Gang, 800-848-WABC, taking your calls in reaction to my discussion with Monsignor Stephen Rossetti. What'd you make of that? I thought it was pretty powerful. It caused me to give a lot of thought to some things. 800-848-WABC. Joe is on Staten Island. Hello, Joe.
Hello. I heard your interview, and it was interesting to say the least, because it's harder than normal, which is really... If you look at it from that side, you know, the true side of it, it's really the normal, because there's a supernatural world that controls the physical world that you're limited to seeing. And some things he said are true, and some things he said are not true about the preventing. You know, the first of all, you know, just to get the idea, I'll just make short points, and you'll get the idea later, because I don't take up all your time.
Well, thank you.
Is that okay? You want to say something?
No, go ahead. We got about a minute left, Joe. Go ahead.
Oh, goody, good. Thanks for the time with you. There is no such thing as holy statues. You know, I guess he means not non-holy statues, like not pictures of people doing things or something that doesn't exist, that's demonic or that looks ugly. Maybe that means that. But there's no such thing as holy. Holy means like, he means holy like, supernatural. There's no supernatural statues. If you think there, you can think whatever you want.
Joe, thank you. We'll continue with your calls in just a minute. 800-848-WABC. TWA Flight 800, 25 years ago this weekend. What happened? We're going to get into it at 2:30. We'll take your calls on this and a wide variety of other subjects. This is The Other Side of Midnight. As the great Bob Barker used to say, help control the pet population. Make sure you have your dog or cat spayed or neutered.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Everybody, this is The Other Side of Midnight, 25 years ago Saturday. TWA Flight 800 went down. What was the cause? Do you believe we've been told the true story? We're going to talk with Bill Burns. He is one of our favorite. He's a New York Times bestselling author and an investigative journalist and sort of one of my favorite. I feel silly giving him this description because it almost sounds dismissive of his scholarship, and a lot of what he said has turned out to be verifiably true. But he's one of my favorite conspiracy theorists, whether it's on UFOs or whether it's J. Edgar Hoover or the Kennedy assassination or anything else. Pretty interesting guy to talk to. I'm looking forward to talking with him at 2:30. Fascinating conversation with Monsignor Rossetti. I mean, I don't know how you listen to that conversation and don't say, wow, here's a guy whose team is doing 15 to 20 exorcisms a week. A week. Wow. And again, the thing that really blew my mind And I haven't read his book yet, but I've read excerpts of it and I've read summaries of it. But the thing that really blew my mind is what he was saying about demons sending text messages. I mean, who thinks a demon is going to send a text message? I don't know why they should be exempt, though. Apparently, everybody's been doing it. Have you noticed the tremendous uptick in spam text messages? My wife is getting them all the time. I'll be honest, I don't know what it is with my phone. I'm afraid to say it, but I rarely get the spam text messages. Occasionally, I'll get some political spam text messages. Like, this is Congressman or Councilman so-and-so. Can I count on your support for X? But she gets all sorts of, you know, weird text messages that she never signed up for. And I've been hearing from a lot of friends and family that have been getting a barrage of spam text messages. So I'm curious if that has been happening to you as well. 800-848-WABC if you want to share your experience. 1-800-848-9222. And that leads me to one thing I've had on my list since Tuesday. Something the governor did, which I actually agree with, is he signed legislation that makes these anti-telemarketing laws apply to text messages as well. So this law that the governor signed last week adds text messages, SMS text messages, to the state's definition of telemarketing in addition to robocalls. Remember, we had these do not call registries, these do not call lists. And if a telemarketer calls you and you're on the do not call list, they could get in trouble. Now, text messaging had been exempt from that. And as of last week, at least in New York, now it is no longer exempt from it. So hopefully, for those of you that have been dealing with this stuff, hopefully this will give you a little bit of a break. But it is expanding New York State's definition of telemarketing to include marketing by text message. New Yorkers have protection now, according to this legislation, against unwanted robocalls. But texting was not previously defined as telemarketing. This legislation closes that loophole. I think that's certainly good news. 800-848-WABC if you want to comment. In a statement, the governor said, "Our consumer protections need to keep pace with technology, and New Yorkers who have long been plagued by the nuisance of annoying calls from telemarketers now have to contend with unwanted texts attempting to sell them things they don't want. This legislation closes this annoying loophole and will help ensure our laws are modernized to confront the needs of New Yorkers." 800-848-WABC. Barbara on Long Island has been very patiently holding. Hello, Barbara.
Hi, Frank. Thanks so much for taking my call. You are the fairest, most open-minded talk show host in this area. And I really am so glad you're on.
Oh, Barbara, thank you. I don't know how I'm going to get my head through the door after after you made it so big. Thank you.
It's true, Frank. Really it. And also, as far as renaming the streets, it's the most ridiculous thing. There's going to be nobody on the streets if they don't tackle this crime. My husband and I are thinking of moving back to the city, but it is a concern. And it's a crime that it's going on the way it is. And this is the most, the ridiculousness of it. It's just political patter. I can't stand it. So I totally agree, and I don't want to take up your valuable time, but well, I'm so glad you're on, Frank.
Thank you, Barbara. I'm glad you're listening. I'm glad you're calling, and I appreciate the nice words, hopefully. And you're exactly right. I mean, it's much easier to do something. It's much easier to rename the George Washington Bridge than it is to actually put an end to five separate shootings that took place in one day on Friday. And thank you very much for the call. 800-848-9222. If people don't know what Barbara's talking about, she's talking about this push from Eric Adams locally and Elizabeth Warren, among others nationally, to rename everything that might be offensive to somebody. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Julie is in Brooklyn. Hello, Julie.
How are you, Frankie?
Oh, this is Big Julie, the one and only.
Right.
The original.
I've got to make a comment about the father, the Monsignor, actually. All that stuff is true. I've had things happen to me that scratches. I had a claw mark across my back where it burned so badly, waking in the middle of the night, the knockings at the door, until one day, you know, God is very important. And I was never into tarot cards or Ouija boards. Sometimes it just happens. When you're a dedicated man to God, sometimes they even come closer to you because they want you to be the same dedication to Satan as you would God. And sometimes they come to get you to get away from me. And I'll tell you the truth. You know how it all stops, Frankie, for me? I'm going to tell you the truth quickly. I know you got a minute. I don't know if it was a dream or a reality. And I'll tell just a quick story of what happened to me. And to show you that Satan is really there. One night, I was either sleeping. It felt like it was a real deal. And I come to this warehouse. And it looked like the Garden of Eden. And I came to this gray building. And the doors opened up, and it was Satan's home. I looked on the inside, and everything was gray, cold, and colorless. And Satan wanted me to walk through. I didn't want to do it. I was scared. All of a sudden, I felt the presence of God. And he says, walk through. And I can actually hear them talking, in a way of mentally talking, saying, he's going to follow me. And the Lord out of nowhere said, no, he's not, because he believes in me more than you. And I took the walk, and I can actually feel the cold breath of Satan blowing on me. And I was frightened for a minute, but knowing that God was there, I took the 100-foot walk to a path in Satan's home. It was a gray warehouse, colorless and cold and breathing, and I can hear him breathing. And I slowly walked to the end, and I turned around and slowly walked out. And he actually bet on my life that I was going to go towards him. And that's what happened to me. But I had the scratches. I had the my legs shaking three times at night, knocking on my front door. And I wasn't into anything. It just happens like that. But it is real out there.
Wow.
And Satan is there.
That's incredible.
It's a frightening thing. And I'll tell you, Frankie, when you get the scratches, I said to my wife, I said, I got this burning. There were three claw marks spaced about 2 inches apart across my back, and they burned so bad. And like I said, I was never into anything, but I believed that he did that so because I was as dedicated to God, and he would have loved the dedication towards him.
Let me ask you, Julie, aside from that that episode where you kind of had to walk down a path and choose which one you were going to follow, did you consult with any priest or anybody from the church about how to help you through this process?
No, actually, I live in a totally Jewish building in Williamsburg. I'm a superhero. And let me tell you something, of all the places that you would think that he's not around, he's here. But I always believed in God, and I always spoke to Jesus myself. But I really felt the strength and believed more after that walk. And I can actually feel, and let me tell you something, Frankie, I didn't ask God for that walk. He actually came to me, and I did that walk. It was the funniest thing, Frankie. I was just looking through that warehouse in the Garden of Eden, like, but it was so real. And all of a sudden, I could actually feel that yellow glow. I didn't see him, but I can actually hear them thinking, and Satan saying, hey, he's going to be with me. And God says, no, he believes in me more than you. And I'll tell you the truth. If I didn't take that walk and believe in God, who knows what would have happened on the other side.
Julie, that is a wild story. I appreciate you sharing it.
Yeah. I just want people to know that it's real out there. Even if you're not into tarot cards or Ouija boards, sometimes it just comes around, especially if you're even dedicated to God and he tries to gamble on you to see what's going on with the devil. So I tell people, don't play with that stuff, and he's really real. And once in a while, I get an occasional visit from the other guy, and I throw the salt and I say the blessing, and It's real. If the Monsignor's listening, it's really out there.
Wow.
And he knows it too.
Well, yeah, clearly. He's on the front lines. Julie, thank you. 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. We're going to talk about the TWA Flight 800 disaster coming up in about 15 minutes, taking your calls in the meantime. It's 1-800-848-WABC. Carol is in New Jersey. Hello, Carol.
Hey, Frank. It's so great to talk to you again.
Thank you. You too.
I was raised Catholic, and I learned from a very early age that you don't dabble in that kind of stuff. Let me tell you about my sister. She got involved in Wicca and the tarot cards and the Ouija boards and all that stuff. She had nothing but bad luck in her life after that. Nothing but bad luck.
Well, that would seem to jive with what the Monsignor was saying.
Yes, absolutely. The Monsignor is right. You don't get involved in that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Now, look, I'm sure there are a lot of people that use Ouija boards and tarot cards, and they don't have any ill effects. But he was saying in his experience that it makes possession much more likely. I'm not an expert. I don't pretend to be. That's
right.
Just what he was saying. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Steve is in Manhattan. Hello, Steve.
All right, Big Frank, and Carol from New Jersey has the sweetest voice in talk radio.
Yeah, she's a nice lady. You could tell.
She is. They're actually the Carol twins. There's a Carol from Queens that calls in, too. But the thing is, first with Andrew. Andrew Cuomo could quit politics tomorrow morning, fly out to Hollywood, and easily command $20 million a movie. Andrew could play the heavy in any movie ever. Just look at that press conference last week. Now, folks, this is what's going on. This is the first time this has ever happened. There's actually a war going on, but only one side knows it's going on. The hard left is sending a wrecking ball through Western civilization. I mean, I remember I was a young guy at the time when Pat Buchanan gave the culture war speech at the 92 convention. The man nailed everything one by one. Now, folks, a lot of people get upset when I say this, but the truth is the hard left has been rebuilt in this country through the 65 Immigration Act. They're trying to teach young school kids that white people are the R word. And the reason why is because whites make up 40% of the Democratic Party. And that's a fact. They're a minority. And what they're doing now is they're abusing the minority. That's what they're doing. And tonight, folks, no Harpo jokes.
Fair enough. Thank you, Steve. 800-848-WABC. Joe in Queens has been very patiently holding.
Hey,
hello,
how
Joe.
How you doing?
Good.
Yeah, very interesting call from Julius, but it weighs in with what I was thinking about the interview. Like he said, Garden of Eden, and then he saw the Wicked Warehouse. And if you think of that Tom Cruise movie, how Eyes Wide Shut, how he passed through those red flags. And I think that what happens with these enticements is the devil or Satan will make things look glossy or glamorous at the outset, and then they go a little further and you find the dark side a little bit later. So it's like going to a party and you think it's a fairly normal party, then all of a sudden all this creepy stuff shows up a little bit later on. So it won't be like The Exorcist up front, because then you'll just hit the highway. It'll come in a little bit later. What do you think, Frank?
Well, hey, it makes sense to me. It makes sense to me. Pope Francis, Pope Benedict, Pope John Paul II, these aren't exactly people that are prone to episodes of irrational hyperbole. And all of them acknowledge the importance of exorcism as what goes on in the Catholic Church. So I absolutely believe it. I can't imagine Monsignor Rossetti is making up stories about doing exorcisms of people whose eyes turn black all of a sudden, or whose eyes turn serpent-like, or people who have an upside-down cross appear on their body out of nowhere. And then some other things that he said is that a lot of people, if they're possessed and they are struck with holy water, they start vomiting white foam. I think it's wild. I think it's wild. 800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight. We'll talk about the TWA Flight 800 disaster in just a bit. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.
I drink too much, I'm too proud, I'm an easy touch and I'm too dang loud. I do a lot of things that I ought not do, but I'm not different, I'm just me, and that's the only way that I know how to be. So if I'm wrong, that still ain't nothing new. You know, I ain't never asked for a lot, and that's about all that I've ever got. But there's one thing that I sure would like to see.
James Hand, Here Lies a Good Old Boy. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. It's Monday. Hopefully you had a nice weekend. Christian, we missed you on Friday. Did you have a nice day off?
I did. It was very nice.
Yeah, that's good. Did you get to catch up on sleep?
I did. Got to go to the beach because it was nice out. Back-to-back days, that Friday and Thursday.
Which beach do you go to? Out on Long Island?
Long Beach. I live two blocks from the beach.
Well, that is on Long Island.
Yes.
Yeah, so you had a nice weekend then.
I did, yes.
Very
Thank
good.
You for asking. How was the Catskill?
I think it was just fine, but first I have to ask Molly about her weekend. Otherwise, we're accused of gender inequity here if we just ask you how your weekend was, and then people that are on the edge of their seat want to know how Molly's weekend was. All of a sudden, we don't ever get to hear about that. How was your weekend, Molly?
Well, I'm sure some of the listeners know that I was here. With Frankie Russo working one of the nights. But I also did get to enjoy a little time off. I was out in my neighborhood enjoying a meal, and there was a brass band playing at the restaurant. But maybe 15 minutes into the set, a quinceañera is marching down the street and a mariachi band is playing across from the brass band, so it's a real life battle of the bands.
Oh,
so that
really?
Was really interesting.
How did the brass band react to the kind of the competition from the mariachi band?
It's actually interesting because I expected somebody to stop playing, but both bands powered through. They were not giving up, either one of them. A little bit of eyeing each other up, but everybody was really smiling because it was just kind of a cute New York moment.
That's very nice. That's cool. I'm glad you, I'm sorry you had to work, but, you know, I guess everybody's got to work once in a while. And, I'm glad that you had a, you know, a chance to relax a little bit. So as Christian mentioned, I did go to the Catskills on Saturday. My friend Dan, who is an attorney and a guy that I've known for a long time and a nice guy, throws this big barbecue up in an area called Highland Lake, which is in Sullivan County, New York. And he basically said, I want you to invite anyone you want to this party. And he throws a barbecue, and it's right on the lake, and it's a great, great thing. And so I invited a whole bunch of people. And my wife said to me, she's looking at the weather predictions, and there's rain predicted, there's thunderstorms predicted, flash flooding predicted. At one point, there was a tornado warning predicted, and she was saying how she didn't want to go. She said, look, and my wife is with child, if you don't know, and she was saying, look, I don't really want to drive over 2 hours to go there and sit in the rain. And she looked at the restaurant where the party was being held and photos online. She said, it doesn't look like they have much of an indoor area. She said, it looks like they have this tiny little bar, and I really don't want to stand there in the rain under a tent getting rained on. She's showing me all the weather forecasts, and sure enough, there's all these high pressure systems and floods coming in. And then, you know, we had a mini, mini argument, and she said, all right, here, I will only go if you can find something else fun for us to do up there that's not dependent on the weather. So we had already made arrangements to stay at the Resorts World Casino up there in Monticello. And that only added to her reluctance. She said, I don't want you to sit there and gamble for 8 hours. We'll be out of house and home. So I pointed out all the different things that go on there. There's an indoor pool at this hotel. There's a spa. There's all sorts of stuff. There's restaurants. There's a bar. And so ultimately, she agrees to go up there. So we get up there on Saturday, afternoon. And lo and behold, we ended up having beautiful weather the entire time of the barbecue. I'm getting all sorts of alerts for what's happening down in New York City. There's tornado warnings down here, flash flood warnings down here, thunderstorm warnings down here. We had outstanding weather up there the whole afternoon right on the lake. Not a drop of rain the entire time we were out, up there. So, and it turns out about half the people that attended this party were people that I invited, were my friends. And it was great to see Dan, and Michael Faulkner was there. It was great to reconnect with him. Some of you may remember him from when he ran for New York City controller. He's living in Philadelphia now. He's a reverend, used to play for the Jets. Peter Gleason was there. A bunch of interesting people were there. I got to meet a lot of interesting people. And it was a wonderful party, and Dan was very nice to go out of his way like that. He had an open bar, and it was really a great, great time. So then we end up going to the Resorts World Casino, and we had a lot of other friends that were staying there or weren't staying there, but were at least visiting, and they were hanging out with us there. And we had, you know, we had drinks with some friends. We had an appetizer with some friends. We're hanging out. We're having a good time. And then I said, all right, now, the previous week in Atlantic City, I had done pretty well. I don't like to go on about how much I win, because I also don't like to tell you how much I lose, because both can be – one sounds idiotic. If you lose a lot of money gambling, you just sound like an idiot. And if you win a lot of money gambling and then you talk about it, it sounds like you're bragging. And I don't like to do either of those things. But I will – I'll tell you a little bit just to give you some proper context. So the first thing I do when I get to the Resorts World Casino, because they now allow sports gambling in New York, the first thing I do is I lay down $190 on the Mets to win, because they're playing the Pirates. Pirates are a horrible team. They're in last place. And the Mets, in spite of themselves, are in first place. And when I was in Atlantic City the previous week, I lost $100 on the Mets. I said, what are the chances that I'm going to bet the Mets and the Pirates twice in 2 weeks and the Mets are going to lose both games? So I plunked down my $190 on the Mets. We're meeting with friends or having drinks, hanging out. I said, all right, well, let me play a little baccarat. Now, the previous week in Atlantic City, I had won a total of about $1,800 on baccarat and craps. And I was ahead by more than that. And in my head, I said, well, you know, wouldn't it be something to supplement my income if I was able to win a minimum of $1,500 each week? I mean, that would be a nice little chunk of change. So then that's the number that I had in my mind for this Catskills trip. So we're at the baccarat table. My wife's standing behind me along with our friends Dan and Gene. And I'm doing well. Doing really well. I'm up 600, 700, 800, 900, 1,000. And at one point, and now I wouldn't let any of them move because, you know, gamblers are superstitious. So I don't want them screwing up the mojo while I'm winning. So at one point, I'm up $1,200. But obviously, I can't walk away because I have to get to 1,500. And so I lose that $1,200 that I was up. And I end up just being up $5 at baccarat instead of $1,200. My wife was as furious as you can imagine. And my friend Dan, all he wanted was a Frankfurter. And then I kept saying, no, don't leave yet, don't leave yet. And we go to the hot dog stand, and they had closed 8 minutes before that we got there. So he never got his Frankfurter, but I bought him a hamburger instead. So then they end up going to bed. And then I hit the craps table, playing a little craps. Lo and behold, the Mets managed to blow a seven-run lead. Seven-run lead. They're leading 7-0 going into the eighth. And the Mets did the Metsiest thing that you can do. They gave up 8 runs in 2 innings to cost me my $190. So then, you know, I'm down a little bit. I'm down, I think, $90 after I rolled the dice once. You know, so I'm down $90. Play craps a little bit, you know, I win a couple $100 there. And I said, all right, let me hit the baccarat table again before I go to bed. And I did well at baccarat. I met my $1,500 quota. I think I finished ahead, I think around $1,800 or so. And then I'm explaining to my wife, Now, see, imagine if we could do this every week. We'll go to Atlantic City or somewhere every week, and I'll win $1,500 at Baccarat. Wouldn't that be great? Now, I'm working on it for next weekend, because next weekend there is a lot going on in Atlantic City. They have that mob movie con there. Armand DeSante is going to be there. And while I'm still on this hot streak, especially until the baby's born, I'm thinking we should take advantage of this. But she thinks this is not a viable long-term financial strategy. But we had a great time. It was my first time up in the Catskills, and it was really just such beautiful scenery. And even when it was raining at night, it was a great little hotel that they have up there, very modern, very clean. Food up there in the hotel was not the best. But then we went to a great diner for breakfast yesterday morning, and we just had a fine, fine time. Couldn't ask for a better weekend. So great party that Dan threw, and it was a great experience up there. I mean, it is tough to travel 2 hours each way in the car, but my wife did the bulk of the driving. She did all the driving, actually. I slept, and it was great to connect with some old friends and have a good time. Hey, TWA Flight 800, what happened? Do we know the full story? We're going to talk about it with Bill Burns next. This is The Other Side of Midnight, straight ahead.
The Other Side of Midnight presents The Midnight Files.
Midnight in the desert. Shooting stars across the sky. This magical journey will take us on a ride. Filled with the longing, searching for the truth. Will we make it till tomorrow? Will the sun shine on you?
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Moreno. Saturday was the 25th anniversary of what happened on TWA Flight 800. And I mentioned this a little bit Friday morning, that I was going to look to talk with James Kallstrom today, who was the assistant director of the FBI that was in charge of this investigation. I've interviewed Jim Kallstrom many times over the years. Lo and behold, I get an email back almost immediately from a listener that said that he had just died a couple of days before, and they actually had his funeral on Friday. How interesting is that, that his funeral took place the day before the 25th anniversary of the explosion of TWA Flight 800. So Sunday mornings, I'm on with the owner of our radio station, John Catsimatidis, as part of the local edition of the Cats, or the hyper-local edition of the Cats Roundtable. And this is what John Catsimatidis said in discussing the anniversary and discussing Jim Kallstrom's funeral.
On our local edition of the Cats Roundtable, we have an old take. Yesterday was the 25th anniversary of Flight 800. Friday, it was the funeral of Jim Kallstrom, the FBI director that investigated Flight 800. And I'll tell you something. I don't think we know fully what happened to Flight 800. What I've heard is they've tried to they said that the middle tank blew up. A lot of people said they saw a missile going at it from a boat. A lot of, you know, someday maybe that the truth will come out on Flight 800. Maybe at 3 o'clock in the morning with Frank Moreno on the other side of midnight.
Now, that was awfully nice of John to give us a plug like that, because he does have a big audience Sunday morning. But I thought, why don't we actually try to get to the truth? I have seen the TWA Flight 800 Memorial in Suffolk County, and seeing the flags of all the people who came from countries that died on that plane. It's incredibly moving, and it's incredibly emotional. So, TWA Flight 800, July 17th, 1996. It exploded and crashed into the Atlantic Ocean near East Mauritius at around 8:30 at night, 12 minutes after takeoff from JFK Airport on a scheduled international passenger flight to Rome with a stopover in Paris. All 230 people on board died in the crash. It is the third deadliest aviation accident in U.S. history. And there are a whole bunch of people that I've spoken to that don't believe the official story. And one of the people that has tended to dig deep into a lot of these stories and question the official story that we get from the government on a bunch of these things has been William Burns, an investigative journalist, researcher, and a New York Times best-selling author. Bill, it is great to talk with you. Thank you, as always, for joining me at such a tough hour.
Oh, thanks for having me, Frank.
So, Bill, when did you begin investigating this and questioning the official story that the government told us?
Minutes after the crash, and I'll tell you why. I'm very good friends and an agent. I was his literary agent for the reporter who really broke the first story about what really happened to Flight 800, Jim Sanders. And this was literally days after the crash. Jim Sanders and a few of us were working with a motion picture company in Los Angeles on books about American POWs being held back in Vietnam. Jim Sanders' wife was a flight attendant manager. She was a trainer. She trained part of the crew on Flight 800 that crashed that night. So they're watching television, and they see the report on CNN about the crash. And then suddenly the United States Navy, get this, the United States Navy pops, this is like minutes after the news. The United States Navy pops up and says, oh, the Navy didn't shoot down the plane with a missile. So Sanders, who was a Seal Beach Police Department crash investigator, right? He's the guy that writes the crash reports for insurance companies, for the court. He says, wait a minute. In a Columbo fashion, right? Why would somebody say, I didn't commit a crime when you were never accused of committing a crime, right? The Navy says, we didn't shoot the plane down. Nobody says, hey, Navy, you shot the plane down. So Sanders begins investigating. And at the end of the day, the story, the larger story itself stretches all the way back from Operation American Flag in the 1980s under Ronald Reagan, when we were sending ships through the states of Hormuz under an American flag protection, all the way to, get this, the 2016 election, Jim Kallstrom and James Comey. That's how big this story is. It's incredible. What really happened, Frank, was that after we shot down a plane.
Well, let me ask you to pause 1 second, Bill, before we get into what really happened. For people that might not have been, for people in our audience who might be a little younger, or for people that may simply not remember the official story the government told us, what exactly did the government say after their investigation about what they determined to be the official cause of this explosion? And then how does that differ from your reality in your judgment?
When the government, when the NTSB began investigating the crash, the NTSB rebuilt the plane in the Calverton hangar. But at the time, the FBI was involved in the crash investigation. While the government was saying this was an accident, the center wing tank exploded, by the way, on a 747, which has been in service for over 40 years. Never did a center wing tank explode before that crash, and never has a center wing tank exploded after that crash. And when I personally asked an NTSB investigator that I met while we were filming UFO Hunters in New Mexico, and I saw a 747 on a tarmac, and I asked an NTSB investigator, he said there was no way the center wing tank exploded on a 747 that night. But that was the official story, that the wing tank, partially filled, was filled with fumes, obviously, and as the plane climbed to 13,000 feet, it simply exploded from a spark and blew the wings off the plane, and that's what made it crash.
And
totally untrue.
You believe in Jim Sanders, who you were representing as a literary agent. You and Jim Sanders believe that what actually happened is that the United States military shot down this plane.
That's right, because we had three or four eyewitnesses. And by the way, Frank, we have a videotape videotape of missile testing going on in that very same area off the south shore of Long Island a week before the plane was shot down. We were testing a weapon, and this is the weapon we were testing, and it was classified. Now it's not classified anymore, but back then in the late 1980s, we classified this. The weapon was a way for a submarine to receive radio instructions, targeting instructions, data, while the sub was submerged. Remember, when a sub has to receive radio, usually it has to raise its mast, its antenna, just to get the radio instructions, right? Firing a missile, where to go. So the fact that we could direct a sub, send orders to a sub captain while the sub was still submerged, that's a major advance. And it was classified. We used something called a blue-green laser as a carrier signal. And the reason we developed that was that all the way back in Operation American Flag, when we were sending ships through the Straits of Hormuz back during the Ronald Reagan era, one of the ships, I think it was the Vincennes, thought that it was being attacked by an Iranian bomber, by an F-14 that we'd sold to the Shah, and shot down an F-14. But it wasn't an F-14. It was a civilian airliner.
Right.
And there, on the surface of the water, was floating a child's doll. Well, the Navy was horrified. It was a mistake. We admitted it. We paid compensation. But we tried to find a way for this never to happen again. And the way for it to never happen again was to take the firing control, the identification of a target, the firing mechanism, the launch of the missile, the instruction to fire, out of the hands of a human being. We put it into the hands of a computer, an artificially intelligent computer. It was part of the Aegis defense system for submarines, destroyers, for naval vessels. And that night, July 17th, back in, was it, 1996, we were scheduling a test of that Aegis system. We also knew that there was a terrorist plane that was coming in over the Atlantic any time that night. So we set up a naval task force. The plane came in, and we launched a drone because we didn't want – this was a test. So we launched a drone over that same area for the submarine to lock onto to shoot down the drone. While the drone was in the air – and we have photographs of the drone, by the way. While the drone was in the air, TWA Flight 800 bound for Rome and Paris – was late because of storms over O'Hare Airport, because they were waiting for a connecting flight from O'Hare coming from Chicago. But there was storms, so all the connecting flights were held up for an hour. Then Whiskey 105, which is that area off of, in East Riches, off Long Island, that area went hot. But nobody bothered to tell flight control over at JFK. So Flight 800, thinking all was well, waiting an hour, takes off, climbs to 13,000 feet right through the military operations area, the MOA, while a drone is flying overhead. Well, the submarine gets the flight and gets the shoot down instructions to shoot the drone down, launches the missile. Bingo. What happens? Flight 800 flies right through the targeting area. The missile is self-guided. It flies by wire. It's self-guided. It sees a larger target, homes in on the target. That's when the heat seeker head takes over and focuses on the engines of the 747. The Navy, Frank, panics. They see what's happening. We're about to shoot down a commercial airliner. They launch another missile to shoot down the Navy missile that was originally aimed at the drone. Well, the Navy missile turns and hits on the other side of the 747. So two missiles are aimed at the 747. We have eyewitnesses that night on Long Island seeing the missile launch from the water, from the submarine, and seeing the other missile launch aiming at the plane. The first missile blows off the number three engine. That's the inside engine on the starboard wing. Well, immediately the plane tilts over to the left, right? Heels over to the left. That's when the other missile explodes, blows off the wing. Meanwhile, the warhead from the original missile, which contains thermite, only is used in Navy anti-aircraft missiles. That warhead blows right through the seat, right through the cabin in the seating area behind the business section. It blows the front part of the cabin right off. Imagine the panic in the plane, right? With the plane starts heeling over, then the whole front part of the plane goes over and the plane dives into the sea. Now, in the crash reconstruction, what we found out was that officially the number three engine, which was blown off the plane first, so it would be in the western end of the debris field, was physically re-tagged by crash investigators and moved to the eastern end of the debris field. That's cover-up. The plane was reconstructed at the Calverton hangar with the FBI there. And the FBI says, oh, we found explosives on the plane. Sure enough, it was from the Navy missile. They found thermite on the rear seat. So the TWA pilot manager, a man by the name of Terrence Stacy, who knows Jim Sanders and knows his wife, says, hey, Jim, there's all this red material on the back of the seats in business class. And he says, I'm going to send you some. He rips it off, puts it in a FedEx envelope, sends it to Sanders. Sanders has it tested by Thiokol. Bingo, they find thermite in that red material. It's Navy explosive material. That's the smoking gun.
Wow.
Well, one patch goes to CBS News. Well, Jim Kallstrom hits the ceiling. He is furious. Why would a reporter have his hands on that red material? So he calls up CBS, and they serve a warrant on CBS News. And CBS News, like good reporters, dutifully turn over the evidence itself to the FBI that Deep Six is the evidence. Get this, they Deep Six the evidence. Sanders produces the evidence and the test, and they arrest him. In fact, as he's writing the book, which folks can get right now, The Downing of TWA Flight 800, it's online, it's from Kensington Publishing. As he's writing the book, get this, the FBI sends squads out because he goes into hiding to write the book. His wife goes into hiding. They try and arrest his wife to hold her hostage to keep him from writing the book. This is the United States of America. So what TWA does, because TWA is being bought and sold and they're furious about this because their own people got killed, what TWA does is TWA begins flying her around the country to keep the FBI from arresting her. And in fact, when the FBI thinks she's
going to... Her being Elizabeth Sanders.
Elizabeth Sanders, mm-hmm. Yeah, Jim Sanders' wife.
Right.
Instead of getting off at the front section, she gets up at the tail section while the FBI is entering the plane from the front. It's an amazing, amazing story. Finally, at the end of the day, the FBI is furious at the Clintons for deep-sixing it, but the Clintons had no choice. It was a classified information. Wait till 2016 when they discover that Huma Abedin's emails, which contain Hillary Clinton's emails, are on Anthony Weiner's a computer. And who discovers it? Jim Kallstrom, who's furious about having to cover up this crash. And that he pressures Jim Comey. Jim Comey goes public. And that's the 2016 election. And that's how an errant Navy missile under guided by artificial intelligence, brought down a commercial airliner over Long Island and resulted in the 2016 election.
So the cover-up itself was directed from the Clinton administration, not necessarily the top echelons of the FBI.
No, it was directed by the United States, by the Pentagon.
By the Pentagon.
They ordered the Clinton administration not to reveal the existence of the blue-green laser carrier signal.
Which now everyone acknowledges.
Everybody knows that. That's common knowledge now. That was classified in 1987, 88, 89.
If people want to read the book by James Sanders, The Downing of TWA Flight 800, it's available on Amazon or wherever books are sold. We're talking with William Burns, who, in addition to being a veteran investigative journalist himself and a New York Times bestselling author, happened to serve as the literary agent to James Sanders on this book. We don't have very much time, but I want to squeeze in a few quick questions if we can at 800-848-WABC. Jim is in Brooklyn. Jim, you're on with Bill Burns.
Yes, a fascinating story. I agree with everything. I've heard most of it. There's one thing that I have a disagreement about: communication with submarines underwater. I live right next to the Navy Yard, and there is a large horizontal antenna there that's a couple hundred feet long for long-wave communications, and it was used to communicate with U.S. submarines under the Atlantic Ocean during World War II. I just wanted to mention that.
Okay. There was a cable, by the way, underneath the Atlantic Ocean, and that was how a lot of that communication took place.
Very interesting. And, you know, the thing that I often wonder about a lot of these cover-ups is we see how incompetent the government is, the U.S. government is, at handling sometimes very basic tasks like launching healthcare exchanges or things like that. Wouldn't there have been more holes in this cover-up if the United States government was responsible, or is the military a little bit more efficient at things like cover-ups than maybe some other branches of the government?
Exactly the right question to ask, because in the hours after the shootdown, the Clinton administration pulled whistleblower protection from the United States Navy. A lot of people knew this. In fact, we spoke to the chief of a boat in down in Newport News, Virginia, and he said absolutely it was a Navy missile. That naval officers knew, especially CPOs, knew exactly what happened. This was right throughout the Navy.
So in your view, there's no doubt that this investigation should be reopened.
I saw the video, Frank. There was a video, it was on Fox News, there was a video of Target Orange missile material floating on the water with the missile contrail over the whole thing. I saw it with my own eyes when I was at Jim Sanders' house on the very night we started UFO Hunters, because someone sent him that tape.
Amazing. Well, Bill, it is always a fascinating experience talking with you. I am sure we will be talking again very soon and unraveling one of the other great mysteries of the universe.
Thanks, Frank. Have a wonderful evening.
Thank you. Again, talking with Bill Burns. And if you're more interested in this subject and this theory, although Jim Sanders is saying it's not a theory, he's saying it's the truth behind the worst airplane disaster in U.S. history at that time, that a naval missile, the accidental launching of a Navy missile, downed TWA Flight 800, and that the government engaged in this massive cover-up. If you want to read about it, you can check out the book, The Downing of TWA Flight 800 by James Sanders. Fascinating, fascinating stuff. Hey, we'll do commendations next. You want to weigh in, you can do so, 800-848-WABC. It's 1-800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Keep asking questions.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. Happy Monday. Good morrow, everybody. Start of a brand new week. Let's make it a good one. Should have some nice weather this week. At least looks like today is going to be one of those days where I don't think you're going to have rain, and I don't think it's going to be too hot. So today should be a pretty nice day. We'll see. 800-848-9222. We're going to do commendations in just a minute. But a couple of you have been patiently holding. Let me try and squeeze in a couple of quick calls before we get to commendations. Helena is in South Orange, New Jersey. Hello, Helena.
Yes. Thank you so very much, Frank. I don't know if you remember or not. I'm the one that called on Friday about the TW800.
I do, yes. Thank you for alerting me to Saturday's anniversary.
Thank you so very much because, unfortunately, I was almost on that flight.
Wow. Well, now, I mean, it's fortunate that you weren't.
I was scheduled to go to Israel, to leave for Israel 25 years ago on July 17th. I had a ticket for the Israel airline, which I use when I fly to Israel. When I got to JFK, it was jammed, and it was quite a while before the flight time. When I got up to the ticket counter, they offered me $500 to change my flight because El Al had overbooked. And, well, $500, especially at that time, was a lot of money.
Sure, sure.
I was about to accept it when I was hit by a flash of lightning. And I recalled a trip I had taken several years ago to Israel, also on a TWA flight, which made a stopover in Paris, which was an absolute disaster. I don't want to go into the details. So with that in mind, I thanked the ticket person, but I said no thanks. And I took my ticket with El Al, and I went on El Al. When I arrived in Israel, the airport was like a crazy house. Everybody was talking about a plane that went down. And as I was riding to my destination, on the radio they announced it was TWA 800.
Amazing.
And unfortunately, I lost a very close friend who was a stewardess on that flight. But I just want to thank Hashem, as we call him, for telling me not to take that $500.
Well, absolutely. I am. I'm sorry for the loss of your friend, but I'm glad you're still here with us, Helena.
And I want to thank you so, so very much because when you said that you were going to speak to somebody and have them on Monday, I couldn't imagine how you were going to do it so quickly.
Well, we get things done quickly, Helena.
Well, I want to thank you so, so very much. And again, I want to thank you so very much, Frank, for devoting the time.
Thank you, Helena. Thank you for sharing your experience as well. And again, I'm glad you're still here.
Thank you.
800-848-WABC. That's something. You know, you hear about that, whether it's the World Trade Center, whether it's TWA Flight 800, whether it's other instances where one decision or one change of circumstance means everything. In this case, and in the case of a lot of other instances over the years, life or death. Imagine. Oof, wow. All right. Well, on that note, this time of the week, this hour, we generally tend to give a pat on the back to people that deserve one because it's time for
The Other Side of Midnight presents Commendations.
I must begin by giving a commendation to federal judge Andrew Hannon, who ruled that DACA is unconstitutional, and he's blocking new applicants for DACA protection. Now, as a matter of policy, I think if you were brought here illegally as a child, you should absolutely be able to stay. If you're brought here as a 3-year-old, a 4-year-old, as a 5-year-old, and you have grown up in this country, and this is the only country you've really ever known, of course you should not be subject to deportation. Of course you shouldn't. But that is a question for policy makers. That is a question for Congress. Right now, there is one party in control of Congress and the presidency. That party is in favor of passing the DREAM Act, so they should pass it. It's not up to a president, in this case, President Obama, to all of a sudden stop enforcing the law, which is what President Obama did with DACA. He tried to get a deal with Congress. At the time, there was some bipartisan leadership in Congress, and he failed. Well, the solution when you can't work out a deal on a policy issue is not to shrug your shoulders and say, oh, well, okay, I'm taking it upon myself to issue an executive action. No, that's not how the system's supposed to work. And when Donald Trump tried to do things like this, I said the same thing. So my record is very consistent on this. When he tried to do things, again, I don't need to go back and list all my criticisms of Donald Trump. But the point is, my record is very consistent. And President Obama was wrong to do this. Other presidents that have tried to utilize unilateral executive action in a similar way, they've been wrong to do it. And I applaud Judge Hannon for actually saying that this is completely unconstitutional. But he did this in a very responsible way. He said, no new applicants. Obviously, this decision is going to be appealed. No new applicants for now. But for people that are already being protected by DACA, okay, those protections are in place. This is a very sane and sober, responsible decision. I think we need more men like Judge Hannon on the bench. And I applaud this decision, and I'm giving him a commendation. I must also give a commendation to two-time home run derby winner Pete Alonso. My goodness, I love this Pete Alonso. He might be my favorite player in baseball today. He seems like a great guy, and he's certainly a great athlete. And he seems like a very charitable guy as well. Anyway, he once again won the home run derby, and he is incredible. And he won another $1 million in prize money. Last year, from what I recall, he donated that to charity. This is a terrific, terrific athlete. And I'm thrilled that he plays for the New York Mets. And the Mets have taken some – the Mets had some unlucky breaks this week with our star pitcher, Jacob DeGrom, now going back on the injured list, formerly called the disabled list. But one bright spot in this Mets season is once again Pete Alonso. And I am thrilled that he won the home run derby for the second year in a row. How this guy was not named to the All-Star team this season is beyond me. If this isn't what an all-star looks like, I don't know what is. This man has the heart of a champion. And it's funny, I was talking about Howard Johnson on Friday morning. He is wearing Howard Johnson's number these days, number 20. And I think that is a worthy, worthy successor to Hojo. And I hope he's a Met for life. I love this player, Pete Alonso, home run derby champion. Two-time. And I want to commend the Milwaukee Bucks. They won the NBA championship. They won it in five games, right? Five games, Christian? They won it in five games. And this is the first championship since 1971. So very impressive and certainly a great thing for the fans of Milwaukee. And I want to commend all the new words that were added to the dictionary. Over 300 new words and definitions added to the dictionary. You have oof. You have y'all and about 300 other words. And it's tough to become a new word added to the dictionary, but these words have been added. So it's great to see all these new words that are being used by people make it to the dictionary. So congratulations to all the new words and all the people that use it. I want to give a commendation to New York City public advocate Jumaane Williams and his new wife, India Sneed. They were married this past week. And Jumaane Williams, I've never voted for Jumaane Williams. I would never vote for Jumaane Williams. But I've had the opportunity to meet Jumaane Williams many times. And I have to tell you, he is a heck of a nice guy. He's one of the, while he's wrong about many issues, especially related to policing, he is one of the kindest, most honest people that you'll ever meet in public life. And I will tell you, you know, he's talking about running for governor next year against Andrew Cuomo. I hope he does, because the contrast between someone like Jumaane Williams, who's as honest as the day is long, and Andrew Cuomo, who cannot tell the truth about his own name, is so stark. And I think that's going to be very evident in what New Yorkers see. So I think that's great news that they were married. I hope they're very happy together. I'm giving them both a commendation. I want to give a commendation as well to Dolores Diaz Lopez. This is a super mom. Her child was being kidnapped the other day. And there was this deranged stranger who snatched a boy off a Queens sidewalk and threw him into a car. 5-year-old boy. Now, what would you do if you were a mom of a 5-year-old that was snatched off the street? I know a lot of mothers, the first thing they do is start panicking. Maybe once you get your wits, you realize, all right, I got to call the police. Maybe I got to write down the license plate. Well, so this mom grabbed him back. Dolores Diaz Lopez was walking along Hillside Avenue in Richmond Hill Thursday night, taking her 3 kids to see their father when a man she didn't know leapt from a sedan. And her son had just let go of her hand, was running a little bit in front of her on the sidewalk, and the mom was watching him. The next thing she knew, a man sprinted out of the car, grabbed her son Jacob, and ran back to the vehicle with him. Then she sees the man coming out of the car, and she was scared. She screamed, "He's taking my kid." And he picked him up. This is the description from the kid's brother, a 9-year-old. He picked him up like he was a bag of garbage. The car was close by. He opened the passenger door in the back and threw my brother in the car. He shut the door and locked it. So this person has been charged with attempted kidnapping in what's being described as a pretty shocking incident. So Diaz Lopez and her 2 children that were not kidnapped, they spring into action like a trio from an action movie and rescued this 5-year-old boy. This is what the daughter said to the New York Post. "I ran around the other side of the car and tried to open the door." This is an 8-year-old girl. "I pulled it, but it didn't open. The man locked the door with my brother inside the car." And then, according to her other son, Benny recalled the passenger in the sedan asked the kidnapper, "What are you doing?" He was sitting in the passenger seat in the front. And the man who took Jacob said, "We are kidnapping the kid." So then what happens? Jacob, the kid that was being kidnapped, Jacob stood up in the back seat. And the mom pulls him through the front passenger window. This is incredible. She grabbed him through the front window because the windows in the back were locked. So this is incredible. The kidnapper shouts back at her, "Give me that stupid kid back." But by then, a crowd had gathered and the men took off. This is extraordinary. This is a story that could have been a complete tragedy, but for the quick thinking nature of the mom, her 8-year-old daughter, and her 9-year-old son. This 5-year-old Jacob, who knows what could have happened to him? And I am so glad it worked out this way. It's funny, you know, I do tell the story pretty frequently of Curtis's shooting. If people ever call and ask about it for an Ask Me Anything, I'll tell the story again. But Curtis did something similar when he was shot in the back of a taxi cab. There was no way to get out of the back seat. There were no handles. The doors were locked, and he couldn't open the windows in the back seat. He actually escaped from that taxi cab out the front passenger window. And people are always amazed at that story, but that's exactly what happened with this situation with Dolores Diaz Lopez. So I'm glad that they caught this lunatic, and I'm glad that this family is reunited. I want to give a commendation to a gentleman that I've been very, very critical of over the years, and that's Jeff Bezos. I think what Jeff Bezos has done with Amazon, while some aspects of it are pretty impressive, I think it's abominable. They act like a monopoly. They censor authors like crazy. They censor publishers like crazy. They try to swallow up independent bookstores all over the place. I think a lot of what he's done with Amazon is negative. I think a lot of what he's done with the Washington Post is negative. But I will tell you, tomorrow, Jeff Bezos will have nobody in this country applauding louder for him than me. I am wishing him the best of luck with this Blue Origin flight. And I think that what we are seeing with private sector space travel is just wonderful. I love what Elon Musk is doing, love what Richard Branson did, and I love that Jeff Bezos is moving the ball forward when it comes to space travel. And I love what he's doing in terms of who he's bringing with him. He's bringing with him Wally Funk, an 82-year-old female aviator who's finally going to space after 6 decades of training for it. He's bringing with him not only the person that will be the oldest astronaut, but the youngest. He's bringing an 18-year-old with him, too, because a guy bid something like $28 million to be a passenger on the flight. Now it turns out he's got a scheduling conflict. I'd love to know what that scheduling conflict is. But he's giving his spot that he paid for to the 18-year-old. So I think this is great. Now, I think they're only going to be up there a few minutes. And my sister Claudia, when I was explaining how Mary Wallace Funk, they call her Wally Funk, had such a passion for aviation, was inspired by Amelia Earhart, and always wanted to go to space. My sister Claudia, she was very dismissive of the fact that the space flight was only a few minutes. She said, oh, that's nice. She'd probably like it a lot more if she got to spend more than a few minutes up there in space. All right. Excuse me, Claudia. How's your space flight going? I want to commend Vermont. According to a new ranking from CNBC, Vermont has ranked as the best place in the country, the best state in the country to live in. And this is due to a whole bunch of criteria, but far and away, beat out Hawaii. And it saw an influx of new residents during the pandemic as people sought refuge from more densely populated places in the Northeast. This is exactly what happened with my friend Jennifer Sabetti. She wanted a place where her and her dog could run around and not be stuck in their apartment in Manhattan. And they rented a place in Vermont for a few weeks. So they had some tough stretches during the pandemic, but it now leads the nation, Vermont does, for COVID vaccinations. They have super low crime rates. Wouldn't that be nice? They have a robust public health infrastructure. And a lot of people are saying that it's a pretty hospitable climate for business as well. So I want to commend Vermont being named the number one state, according to CNBC. And I want to commend walking. Yes, the act of walking. A new study shows walking can significantly improve not only your physical health, but your mental health. Older men and women who walked for 6 months showed improvements in white matter and memory, while those who danced or did stretching exercises did not. Isn't that interesting? That walking was actually a better exercise in terms of your mental fitness than dancing was. Amazing. I'm a big advocate of walking. I walk all over the place. And I read a book by Dr. Norman Doidge, who I've been trying to get on the show, but he's so busy. I guess he's writing and exploring. He's declined my opportunities to be on the show so far. He wrote, I read both of his books, but he wrote a book called The Brain's Way of Healing, Remarkable Discoveries and Recoveries from the Frontiers of Neuroplasticity. And he chronicled several people whose mental conditions, including in some cases Parkinson's disease, were helped significantly by walking. It's an incredible story. And this latest study seems to underscore that. And the idea that adult brains can be malleable is a fairly recent finding. But science has advanced, and we now know that that's what neuroplasticity is all about. The brain is a very malleable thing. And walking can help build up the brain. This study, these participants were all past the age of 60, and they were inactive, and they worked out for only 6 months. So imagine if they would work, if they walked for a year, for 2 years. Now, this study did not measure the impact of walking on the brains of young people, but I would imagine that it's again, it's just my guess, but I would guess that young people would see a similar health benefit to their brains by walking. So get out and walk around. It's my advice for people. And then lastly, I don't know what the truth is about what potential cover-up happened with respect to TWA Flight 800. But I want to end by giving a posthumous commendation to Jim Kallstrom, who passed away at the age of 78. I knew Jim Kallstrom through interviewing him and booking him on other radio shows for, I guess, the better part of the last 16 years. And I tell you, I was always so impressed with him. I found him to be pretty plain spoken. I found him to be pretty kind. He always went out of his way to go out of his way to accommodate my requests. And he dedicated the bulk of his life to public service. Not only almost 27 years with the FBI, but then after retiring from the FBI, he was called back into service by Governor Pataki after September 11th to be the New York State Advisor on Homeland Security. And he's going to be missed, I think, by a lot of people. And I'm grateful that I had the opportunity to interview him, and I'm grateful that I had the opportunity to know him a little bit. Not well. I don't think we ever socialized. We just had a professional relationship, but he was always, I would say, a gentleman. So, posthumous commendation to Jim Kallstrom. If you want to comment on the commendations that I gave to anybody, you're welcome to, or just comment on anything else. Now's the time. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC.
It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
Wipe out when you first try to shoot the curve.
Taking gas in a bush takes a lot of nerve.
Those hopscotch, bullheads, and pedestrians till old bucket, shout kaya funk, and now it's skate right on.
Sidewalk surfing. Oh boy, when you can't get to the beach, is there any better way to sidewalk to surf than to do so on a sidewalk. Let me correct something, and I try to – I get things wrong all the time, but when I am made aware of them, I try to correct the record right away. I indicated during the commendations a minute ago that the Milwaukee Bucks had won the NBA championship in five games. But according to Christian, who did not comment when I asked him about that a minute ago, he's now saying that the Bucks have not, in fact, won the NBA championship, and they are one game shy of the NBA championship. Is that accurate, Christian?
That is accurate, yes.
All right. So now they're leading the series 3-2, and they have to – when are they playing again?
They play tomorrow night at
They play
nine.
Tomorrow yes. night. So hopefully that commendation – will be proven accurate for the people of Milwaukee. And if they do end up winning tomorrow night, I'm not going to give a new commendation. That will cover you. But if they lose, then their adversaries will get a commendation next week. So I apologize to the people of Milwaukee. Hopefully, maybe that for your sake, that's a harbinger of good things to come. 800-848-WABC. Joe is here in New York. Hello, Joe.
Hi.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
How you doing?
Great. What's on your mind, Joe?
Well, I was really, really interested in your conversation about the TWA crash. No one's really sure. But I worked on that story for quite a while, from the moment the plane was reported crashed. I was on the beach by sunrise. I think we were in Santa Mauritius on the beach, where everybody had satellite trucks waiting to find out whether we would get picked to go out on Coast Guard craft for recovery. And luckily we got picked. I was with a CBS crew at the time, cameraman, and we were out with smaller ships that were leaving the USS Grasp, which was a larger ship that had, cranes to lift heavy parts of the ship out of the water. And we had a lot of ground rules, like we could not shoot bodies being recovered. We had to put our cameras down. And the most interesting thing about that was how flat the ocean was during the recovery, in the recovery field. It looked more like a lake than it did the ocean. There were no waves at all. And it was like glass. And the visibility was incredibly far. Our boat picked up an escape chute, which was just floating in the water, a door, seats, seat covers, personal things like books. It was very eerie. And subsequent to that, it was very, very, tragic. There were bodies lined up on a pier.
Oh, sure.
Complete bodies. Complete naked bodies. It was a horrifying thing. It's really hard to get that kind of stuff out of your head.
Oh, I can't imagine.
When you do this kind of work, and I think I was at 5 plane crashes in my life. I'm retired now, but it's a terrifying thing. You never get these images out of your head, but that's your job. Your job is to just stay focused and try not to get emotionally involved. But it's impossible, knowing these are real people. These are people, lots of children. They were flying on vacation. It was a terrible thing. But I remember specifically James Kallstrom and his presence. Like you said, he was a gentleman. I probably shot interviews with him quite a few times for different people because I was freelanced. He always seemed very honest, very forthright, and very credible because he was so professional. And I don't know if he was telling the truth or only what he was told to tell.
Mm-hmm.
He was a reluctant spokesperson. I never felt like he was completely free to say what he wanted to say. Maybe he had thoughts that maybe the story wasn't the story. But I remember one thing. I don't want to take up all night on this, but I remember two things in particular. We spent a couple days with people in Long Island who had photographs of a missile. One family was having a picnic, not a picnic, a dinner. It was late in the evening, early in the evening rather. They were having a picnic and they were posing for the camera. It was a Polaroid, and you can see in the background what looks like a missile. It was impossible to say what it was. It could have been a reflection of something, but there was definitely something there, and it was going in an upward, high to the left, low to the right, as in the position of it in the background, just accidentally there because they were taking a family photograph. I saw another photograph from Southampton, similar to that. They had the same exact object in the air.
Yeah, I remember at the time they came up with some explanation to why what everybody seemed to think was a missile and what looked like a missile wasn't actually a missile. And that explanation really didn't hold a lot of water with me at the time. But I appreciate you sharing your remembrances, Joe, and I'm glad you were here to
tell us. I want to tell you one more thing about the reconstruction of the plane in the hangar. They made it very clear to us. They said, look at this side of the plane. You can see that the metal is bent outward in a hole, a very large hole, because they reconstructed practically the whole plane was reconstructed. It was unbelievable mm-hmm. to see something like that. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pieces of a plane that they actually put back together without minus the wings. And that's what they said was the tank that had the vapors that exploded by some mysterious spark. I personally never bought that story.
Yeah, same here, and I don't think a lot of other people do. Thank you for the call, Joe. 800-848-WABC. Rick is in New Jersey. Hello, Rick.
Yeah, good morning, Frank. Two quick things, not as important as that other guy's call, but... you said you're going to give up coffee the other day. Have you ever done it? Did you do that?
So I did. I forgot that I had said I was going to do that Friday, and I actually had two cups today. So I'm thinking that I will try to do it for the rest of the week. I'm going to try to do from beginning Tuesday. So I'm going to go Tuesday through Saturday, and we're going to see how that goes.
You know, it's just my luck, Frank. I send you that special coffee, now you go on the ladder. I sent you T-shirts. Did you become a nudist as well? I mean, come on.
I'll be back soon, believe me, Rick.
Okay, I can start off with the death wish. Anyway, on the walking, you commended. You're right on with that, Frank. I work on Broadway seasonal, and when I'm working, my blood pressure is a full 10 points lower than when I'm not working. It takes about 2 to 3 weeks for my blood pressure to go back down when I start walking again. But as soon as I stop, like, because when I'm not walking, or working rather, I walk zero. You know,
well, but the interesting thing to me, Rick, is I don't find that as surprising. And I don't think a lot of people find that as surprising as what we're seeing here in that, look, I think people have known for years that walking is a good form of exercise, but I don't think anybody really, until recently, had a full appreciation for what walking can do for your brain. I think that's the surprising aspect of this study.
Well, your brain is an organ, so I would assume that if the rest of your body is healthy, your brain, I mean, we always think it's our, we don't differentiate our mind and our brain. Our mind is what we're using right now, but the brain is what's creating those thoughts. And the brain I can see being better because of the walking. So then the mind would then, you know, I would assume function better as well.
Well, clearly that's the case, Rick. Whatever the case may be, walk your way to better brain health. Thank you very much for the call, Rick. 800-848-WABC. So Friday, I went out to dinner my wife and I went out to dinner in Bay Ridge, which is a neighborhood in Brooklyn, if you're living elsewhere. And it's funny because we had recently done, I think Thursday or Friday morning, we had done this segment on tipping. And it was interesting. We went to a restaurant. I don't want to mention the name of the restaurant, but It's a restaurant that I've been to once or twice before, and I've never really had a great experience there. It's always been okay. But my wife, when she lived in this neighborhood, she really liked it. It's mostly a pizzeria. They have other stuff, but it's Italian, but it's sort of a higher-end pizzeria. And we went there because the person we were having dinner with lives in that neighborhood too. So we go there, and it's crowded. It's a crowded restaurant. They had a street festival going on, which is one of my least favorite things. Don't get me started. In the future, we'll do a whole separate segment on street festivals. And ironically, you know who was at that street festival? Both Eric Adams and Curtis Lee were there. And they met one another, and they had a brief interaction. I think Curtis was going to post the video of that interaction on his social media. I don't know if he ended up doing it, but it was kind of a weird interaction that was caught on video. You could find it on Curtis's social media. But I go there, and my wife gets her food, and I was starving. Hadn't eaten a whole day. My wife gets her food. The person that we're having dinner with gets his food. My food does not come. Now, we had an appetizer. I had a drink. And my food doesn't come. Their food comes, and I insist that they eat. And now I'm just starving. I'm still hungry after this appetizer because I really hadn't eaten the whole day. And I am just fuming. And now my wife sees me getting ready to erupt. And she says, no, here, have some of my pizza. I said, no, I will wait. I will sit here and starve just to make the point that my food still hasn't come. Where's the waiter coming over and saying, how is everything? You wait until he asks me how is everything. I am going to let him know how everything is exactly. Then if the manager or the owner comes over and asks, how is everything? I will let him know exactly. So I'm waiting. And then my wife gets up to walk over to the waiter. I said, nope, you sit right there and eat. I am waiting for someone to at least look in this direction to give me some indication that they actually care at least a little bit about the service. And the fact that this meal that I ordered, which was not, it was a pizza, is now 20 minutes late while they both got their food. Nothing. Waiting. And at this point, we're now figuring that they have totally forgotten about us. And I'm planning to get the bill and that my food will never have come and leave very little tip. So finally, after 25 minutes or so, and if anything, I'm not exaggerating that 25 minute time. If anything, it might have even been longer than 25 minutes. Finally, my food comes. And the other two are done. They're done with their food. They've been done with it for a while. So the waiter brings a pizza pie and a drink, another drink that I didn't order. And he says, this is on me. Right? Okay. All right. So now that's pretty nice. I'm thinking, all right, they know they messed up. Now they're giving me this free pizza pie and a free drink. Okay, I can't be too upset now. And I have the food. It was okay. It's not great. It was far from the best pizza that I've had. Far from the worst. It was okay. It's good. Done. And then the check comes. The bill comes. And they charged me for that pizza. Now, the waiter is acting like he's giving me this pizza for free by saying, oh, this is on me. Now, it was not on him. The Negroni that he gave me with the pizza, which I never ordered, that was on him. So they gave me a free Negroni, which was fine, which is nice. But they still charged me full price for the pizza after waiting 25 minutes or a half hour. While everybody else, while I was sitting there starving, while these two ate. So then this is where Rachel and I had a difference of opinion. I still, for all my bravado and for all my talk, I still have a hard time not tipping. So I didn't give my usual over 20% tip, but I gave just about 20%. I think the bill was $105. and I gave $20 in cash because it says right there on the bill, tips preferred in cash. I hate when they say that, by the way. All right, either you take credit cards or you don't. Don't tell me the restaurant's okay taking credit cards, but you prefer the tip in cash. But whatever. They prefer the tip in cash, so I took out $20 in cash and gave it to them. She said that I should not have given a full $20. She said I should have tipped less to make a point, which is what we were saying in that segment on tipping a few days ago. But, and again, it's a small business. I know small businesses, especially restaurants, have had a tough time over the course of the last year. That's why I don't want to kind of burn them. I don't want to dog anybody. We're all having a tough time, and whatever. Everybody makes mistakes, and I could have caught them on a bad night. And the food was okay; it was not terrible. So, but it was a terrible experience for me. It put me in such a sour mood. I felt bad for my companions because I was in such a poor mood, and solely because I never got my food. So, but I still tipped. 800-848-WABC if you've ever been in a similar situation. That's 1-800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.
What you say, that you only meant well, but of course you did. What you say,
Jason Derulo,
that it's all for the best, of course it is.
I was so wrong, raw, so long, only trying to please myself. Girl, I was caught up in her lust, when I don't really want.
What You Say by Jason Derulo. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Hopefully what you say is that if you listen to this show, you'll join our Facebook group. If you are on Facebook, we have a group dedicated to discussion of this show. So if you're a fan of the show, or even if you're a detractor, but if you listen to the show, I want to encourage you to join the Facebook fan group. Just go on to Facebook and search Morano Radio Fans and Haters. That's Morano Radio Fans and Haters. And there's discussions of all sorts of stuff. It is funny to me how people react to certain things that are said on this show, and then how others react to those reactions. Like right now, there's a whole discussion going on reacting to Marlena Shivo's theory or thought that Curtis Sliwa should publicly identify his pronouns. Now, Marlena was so clearly being sarcastic, and yet the person criticizing her, I don't think, recognizes that she was being sarcastic. And then you have all these people in this Facebook group, and it's a really wild group. You got to join. You have all these people in this Facebook group, a lot of whom don't necessarily listen to the whole show, but they have no problem commenting on everyone else's comments as if they have listened. So it's very interesting dynamic in that Facebook group. If you are a listener to the show, I would encourage you to join because we're looking to get more well-informed people in that Facebook group. So just search it, Morano Radio Fans and Haters. That's Morano Radio Fans and Haters. And you can also join our standard Facebook page at facebook.com/MoranoFan. That's facebook.com/MoranoFan. That's where we post articles related to this show based on subjects we do, topics we do. It's also where we post the podcast each and every morning to different highlights of the show and the whole show itself. And I am on Twitter as well, at Frank Morano. That's Frank, Morano. In the last week, I have been retweeted by both Kirstie Alley and William Shatner. Now, how cool is that? For a fan of the film Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, to be retweeted by both Kirstie Alley and William Shatner, that is a dream come true. I've just made it. made it. I mean, the only unfortunately, Ricardo Montalban is no longer with us to also retweet me. That's the only thing that would make that experience even more delightful. But you can find me on Twitter at Frank Morano. That's Frank, M-O-R-A-N-O. And throw me a retweet once in a while, especially on the links to Listen Live, because we're trying to continue to grow our listenership. And if you see my tweet, oh, Listen Live now, and then you hit retweet, then the people that follow you will also get to hear the show and see that you're listening to it and you're enjoying it. So we're on Instagram as well. I'm a little less active on Instagram, but I'm trying to be more creative there and try and do some different things. But you can find me on Instagram at Morano Vision. That's M-O-R-A-N-O Vision. If you follow me on Instagram, you'll see a photo I posted from when we went to the baseball game in Coney Island the other day. And Curtis Sliwa came, and I'm there with Curtis Sliwa and Dominic Carter. And it's a rare photo of the three of us. I think the last photo that was taken of the three of us is probably about 9 years old. So you can see the three of us at the baseball game, including there's a candid photo of Curtis and me talking. And it's funny. He asks my advice about politics, and I give him my considered opinion, different things he should be doing. And then I ask his advice about radio, and he gives me his opinion of, you know, different things that I should be doing in radio. So I don't usually post the same photos on various platforms. So if you want to see all the photos that I'm posting, you have to follow me in all three, on all three networks. You have to follow me on Twitter at Frank Morano. Follow me on Facebook at Facebook.com/MoranoFan. And then follow me on Instagram at Morano Vision. That's M-O-R-A-N-O Vision. Because that's my way of encouraging you to follow me in all three places, is that I don't post the same stuff in all three platforms. And if you're not already, you should be subscribed to the podcast. So you can find us through any podcast app, whether it's Spotify, whether it's iTunes. Just search The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano. That's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano. And just hit the subscribe button. And if you've already subscribed, or if you do listen, you can just leave, you can also leave a nice comment or a nice review, and that will help other people on iTunes or all these other podcast platforms find the show. Because apparently, if there's positive reviews and a lot of 5-star ratings, it will affect the algorithm and more people will find it. So could certainly use your help in that regard, continuing to grow the podcast audience. If you don't have any of those podcast apps, but you ever miss a portion of the show and you want to hear it, just go to fmwabc.com. That's fmwabc.com. And of course, you can always email me, frank.morano@wabcradio.com. That's frank.morano@wabcradio.com. Now, as frustrating as it is to be a Met fan, there are a couple of baseball stories, including this rather frightening situation at the Nationals game the other day and a shooting. So we're going to get into that after the top of the hour, and I'm curious if this would affect your willingness to go to a baseball game, if you're worried that a shooting could take place. Because remember, we told you about that plot at the All-Star game where they think that there might have been a situation similar to what happened at Mandalay Bay in Las Vegas, where thankfully a hotel maid possibly foiled this plot to shoot a bunch of people at the ball at the All-Star game. And now to see what's happened at the Nationals game, it is pretty alarming. So we'll, if you're not up on this story, I'll tell you about it in just a minute. And I'm curious about that. And there's some other non-violent related baseball news as well, which we'll get into. By the way, you're going to want to listen to the WABC Early News with Juliet Huddy and me coming up at 5 o'clock. Sid Rosenberg will have all the latest news related to sports, including baseball. You know, it's funny. I was at a friend's yesterday. We came right from the Catskills, and my friend Brendan was texting. And I said, oh, he said, what are you up to? I said, oh, we just got home. He says, come over right now. We're in the backyard in the pool. And my wife really wanted to go in the pool. And I wanted to see Brendan and his wife, Jessica. And so we go back there. And they have a radio that I got them. So what do? I immediately turn it on WABC. What was airing at that time was the best of the Bernie and Sid show, which really is a great show. So the first thing I hear is a segment that begins with Sid Rosenberg saying, yeah, Frank Moreno, I love Frank Moreno, but he's a total psycho. I tell you, only Sid can make it sound somewhat endearing. Want to wish a happy birthday to Rock and Roll Hall of Famer Brian May from Queen and actor Anthony Edwards from ER. It's his birthday today as well. So happy birthday to you if you're celebrating your birthday. Until next hour, your influence counts, so use it.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Frank Moreno taking your calls until 5 o'clock this morning when Jet Set Juliet Huddy and me will bring you a whole bunch of interesting news. There's a very interesting situation at the Nationals game. So this was, I guess this was on Saturday night outside Nationals Park in Washington, D.C. Three people were injured in a shooting Saturday night. You had a fan outside of the stadium, one of three people wounded. It's according to the police. The fan who was shot is expected to recover, thankfully. Police initially said in statements posted on Twitter that four people were shot. The two other people wounded in the shooting were associated with a recovered vehicle and are now in the hospital being questioned by police. So it's unclear what their exact involvement was with the incident. And the police are saying that those individuals were known to law enforcement. CNN, journalists that were inside the ballpark at the time, they reported hearing multiple loud bangs during the bottom of the sixth inning in a game between the Washington Nationals and the San Diego Padres. Fans fled their seats and sought shelter after hearing the gunfire. The police said there ultimately was no threat to the people inside the stadium. So this was a shootout involving two vehicles outside the ballpark. But question one is this. In light of this, and in light of the fact that you had this gun plot where a whole bunch of munitions were recovered in a hotel room within shooting distance of the stadium where the All-Star game was taking place in Denver, are you any more reluctant to go to a baseball game for fear of this, for fear of gun violence? I'm not talking about fear of COVID or fear of traffic or fear of parking fees. Is there any part of you that's reluctant to go to a baseball game now for fear of gun violence? 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. That is question one.
A question. Since before your sun burned hot in space and before your race was born, I have awaited a question.
And here's question two. This is a lot more focused on the game itself and a lot less focused on gun violence. This was a fascinating article in The Economist, and I'm going to link to it If you haven't seen it, on my Facebook page, facebook.com/MoranoFan, that's facebook.com/MoranoFan, headline, baseball risks irrelevance if it doesn't adapt. And it just came out Saturday. And it says the sport's focus on its history makes changing the game and its culture difficult. And it's an interesting story, but it goes into, and you can't really read much of it if you don't have a subscription to The Economist, but it talks about the difficulty that baseball is having attracting young people. And it talks about how this past year has been tough for sports in general, but it's been especially difficult for baseball. And it talks about how the league has cracked down on the sticky stuff that pitchers use to help them grip the ball. Talks about how a star pitcher from the Dodgers is being investigated for assault. It talks about all these assault-related suspensions among MLB stars. Talks about how the league suffered operating losses of about $3 billion in 2020. But I'm curious, this will be question two. Do you agree with this premise in The Economist that baseball risks irrelevance if it doesn't adapt? And if you do agree with that premise, what sort of adapting would you like to see baseball do? 800-848-9222. That is question two.
A question. Since before your sun burned hot in space and before your race was born, I have awaited a question.
So those are your two questions. Take either one you want. One, does the gunfire at the Nationals game on Saturday and the fact that there was quite possibly a shooting plot at the All-Star game, does that make you reluctant to go to a baseball game? I'm thinking of going back to the Cyclones game this Thursday night. They have Irish night, and Malachi McCourt is thrown out the first pitch, and he's going to be singing between, I think, the first and second inning or the second and third inning. So I am a fan of Malachi McCourt, and I'm certainly a big Cyclones fan. I'm thinking of going Thursday. The gunfire thing is not disrupting my plans to go. If I don't end up going, it will be because I choose to sleep instead of going. But I'm curious if this makes you maybe a little less likely to go to a baseball game than you otherwise would. And I'm also curious if you agree with this article in The Economist that baseball risks irrelevance if it doesn't adapt. What do you think? 800-848-9222. Christian, any thoughts on this? I know you're not necessarily the biggest baseball fan in the world, but in some ways, you're exactly the kind of person who baseball will have to attract in order to grow, because you're a sports fan, but not necessarily the biggest baseball enthusiast.
Yes. So I don't think the violence that occurred outside of the Nationals Park, or the alleged plot that was foiled outside of the Colorado Rockies Stadium for the All-Star game, will dissuade me from going to baseball games. Like I've said, I actually enjoy going to baseball games. I don't enjoy necessarily the sport, but I enjoy the kind of the pageantry that goes along with it and going to a game. So that keeps me interested in going to games. But as far as updating and modernizing, yeah, I agree. I think there are certain things that need to change with the game. What that exactly is, it's tough to say, because baseball is such a traditionalist sport that it's tough for it to get out of its own way, even in its sort of old school mentality of, you know, if someone celebrates or bat flips, you know, they got to get the pitcher of the opposing team has to throw a ball at them. They can't celebrate for whatever reason. That drives me crazy. Why? You know, you just hit a home run, you should be able to celebrate any way you want. And you see it kind of shifting away from that with some of the new characters. But it's tough to say. I think the slow pace of the game has really drawn people away from it, and especially younger people who don't have the attention span to sit there for 9 minutes.
Molly, what's your story? Are you a baseball fan?
So the only time I've ever been to a baseball stadium was for the Pinstripe Bowl. So I went to Yankee Stadium for a football game.
Huh.
And that's about as far as my baseball knowledge goes.
It's safe to say that the gun violence at the Nationals Park will not prevent you from attending a baseball game in the future.
No, just
your lack of interest in baseball will prevent you from
that,
attending
just
a baseball
that.
Game. 800-848-WABC. What say you? Oh, it's 1-800-848-9222. E. Frank is in Astoria. Hello, E. Frank.
Yes, good afternoon, or good morning.
Morning,
Frank.
Yes, Frank,
I'm going to tell you something. I'm very reluctant to attend a baseball game or a local event where there's a large crowd in attendance because I know for a fact that there are people who carried illegal weapons sometimes and they have gripes against others and they have this tendency to erupt a gunfire. I'll tell you, here in Queensbridge, we have hip-hop artists, two that are left, and in general throughout the city, there are hip-hop artists, money game schemes, and people have that tendency. And, you know, I want to say Commissioner Dermot Shea keeps indicating that he's doing the best he can, that he has statistics, that he's going to send officers to locations to patrol the subways. And whenever you go to sometimes a certain hours of the day or night, they're not officers there all the time logged in or locked in the area patrolling. They kind of rotate back and forth, and you can never see them coming around. And then when something goes wrong, Commissioner Shea says this, he says that, he says, I have a new strategy. I mean, you know, I don't know what we're going to do, but to be honest with you, Frank, I am not reluctant to go to an event where I know that someone can have an illegal handgun and conduct an act of random violence and shoot bullets into the air.
Very interesting. Thank you, E. Frank. 1-800-848-WABC. Now, for their part, the owners of the Washington Nationals and the mayor of Washington, D.C., Muriel Bowser, they put out a statement yesterday denouncing the shooting outside Nationals Park. I mean, give me a break. They really needed to put out a statement denouncing the shootings? Did people think that the mayor and the ownership of the Nationals were somehow agnostic on the shootings or they were pro-shooting? Come on, they had to put out a statement denouncing the shootings. So in this joint statement, Mayor Bowser and the managing principal owner of the Nationals called the shooting senseless and said gunplay anywhere in the Capitol won't be tolerated. We stand together against senseless acts of gun violence in the city we love. Gun violence, no matter where it occurs in our city, is unacceptable and will not be tolerated. You know, this reminds me almost of this Eric Adams op-ed in the Daily News on Sunday, where he almost essentially says the same thing. What does that mean? Gun violence is unacceptable and will not be tolerated. Okay, now that we know it's unacceptable, now that we know it won't be tolerated, what are we actually doing? We're saying it's unacceptable? We're saying we're upset about it? Is there anything in the mayor's statement or in this Eric Adams op-ed that actually indicates a concrete plan for doing something about it? Unfortunately, the answer appears to be no. This full statement says, we stand together against senseless acts of gun violence in the city we love. Gun violence, no matter where it occurs in our city, is unacceptable and will not be tolerated. The Metropolitan Police Department continues to work closely with national security to ensure the continued safety of residents, fans, workers, and all individuals in the area. Well, I guess that's an important part of the statement, because if people do get spooked and are afraid to go to a game because they're worried they could get shot, then I guess they need to reiterate that. Lastly, on the baseball front, I don't know if you saw this. I'm going to tweet this at Frank Morano, but you have a situation here where you got to take a look at this. Find me on Twitter at Frank Morano. I just retweeted this. At the Yankees Red Sox game last night, and congratulations to the Yankees, they won resoundingly 9-1. There was a delay in the bottom of the seventh inning with DJ LeMahieu at the plate when Boston catcher Christian Vasquez appears to point out a light to the home plate umpire Manny Gonzalez. So after a discussion with the grounds crew, play resumes. So there's been a lot of concern about using technology to illegally steal signs. So some people thought maybe there was something along those lines. Alex Cora, the manager of the Red Sox, says in describing it, it was a light like a spotlight coming from above the mountains in center field. They have the windows. There was a red light flashing in between pitches. Then it was white. But no big deal, to be honest with you. But Vasquez, that's the catcher, noticed it right away. Aaron Boone, that's the Yankee manager, said that Gary Sanchez noticed the same thing when he was catching and was unsure of its origin. So I just shared the video on Twitter. You could take a look at Frank Morano. That's Frank, M-O-R-A-N-O. Be curious about your take in terms of what it is. All right. Any subject is fair game. If you want to comment on anything we're covering, it's 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-9222. But
it's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
Only in America can a guy from anywhere go to sleep a pauper and wake up a millionaire. Only in America can a kid without a cent get a break and maybe grow.
Only in America. 800-848-WABC. This is America's most powerful talk radio station, 770 WABC. I'm Frank Morano with you until 5 o'clock this morning when the early news with Juliette Hulley and me begins. If you were listening to the early news on Thursday morning, then you might have heard this situation, and that is the fact that there is somebody, you know, I try to save everybody's number when I get a call from them or a text message, but sometimes if I don't have someone's last name, I don't end up sending their number, saving their number. I don't know why. I don't like to say if somebody in my phone is Chris. I like to say it as Chris Wilson. There are a lot of Chris's. So, anyway, there's this person that has been texting me since May 14th of 2021. And I've been answering their text messages, but I have no idea who this person is. This person writes May 14th, "Hey, Frank, are you going to be at, you know, a location today?" I said, "No, I'm returning in June." Then this person writes, same day, "Hey, do you ever pre-record for your show? If so, I have a pretty good guest for you." Now, I didn't respond. A little later on, "I'm working with the firm repping Seth Rogen, and he's getting ready to do some press for Boys." Now, I don't even know. I know who Seth Rogen is, and I would certainly talk to Seth Rogen. But I don't know what Boys is. I don't know if that's his book or a show or a film that he's involved with. But I just say, we can pre-record. So that was the last I hear from this person until Wednesday. Then this person writes me, "Hey, Frank, I know this is very last minute, but I just got two tickets to Chicago at the Beacon Theater tonight at 7:30 and wanted to know if you would like to join me. From what I hear on your show, you have great taste in music." My response, "Thank you. I appreciate that. I'm actually in Coney Island for the Cyclones game tonight." This person writes, "Cool, enjoy." Now, I have no idea who this person is. They're inviting me to concerts. They're pitching guests to me. So I don't know if this is a publicist. I don't know if this is a fan. I don't know who this person is. But I also don't know how you text someone. Look, I guess I'm the jerk because after I got that first text on May 14th, I should have said, "By the way, who is this?" Now at this point, and Juliette says I should still do that. I should say that, you know, I don't know who this is, and I should kind of come clean. But I feel bad at this point that the fact that I'm a total fraud and have been since May 14th, about two full months here, is going to be exposed. But when I text someone, unless it's somebody that I know for a fact, absolutely has my number because we text regularly. When I text someone, I always say Frank M, you know, Frank Morano, or I make clear by the text who it's from. Piscopo, he does that same thing. He'll sign his text Joe P. I don't know how arrogant you have to be to just assume that people have your number when clearly you've never said who you are. So I'm not sure how to handle this. If you have a thought, I'd love to hear it. 800-848-9222. I may go on like this for years with this person. With this person asking me things and I'm answering. They're inviting me to things. Maybe that's what will happen. They'll invite me to something and I'll show up and see who it is. But perhaps I'll be disappointed and I won't want to go. So 800-848-WABC. Any thoughts, Christian?
Yeah, I was going to say, Frank, why don't you just text this person back? Say, hey, this is a new phone number. I don't have your name saved from the last phone. Can you just remind me who this is? That way you don't have to admit, although you already did on radio, you don't have to admit that you don't know who this is and you've been corresponding with them without knowing who they are for this entire time.
Well, so you're saying I should lie and say I have a new phone.
100%. Commit to whatever you've already committed to, just pretending to know this person already.
Well, okay. So you say, sorry, got a new phone, but I don't have this number anymore. That's what you're suggesting.
All right. Yes.
All right. Well, we'll see what happens. 800-848-WABC if you have a differing view. I don't feel great about the Christian solution.
It's all what all the young people do these days.
I know, and I find that annoying too. The Juliet solution, which is come clean and admit that I have no idea who I'm talking to. You have the Christian solution, which is lie and say I'm getting a new phone when in actuality I'm not.
No, that this is a new phone.
New phone.
Yeah. And you don't have the number saved. I just need a reminder real quick who this was.
800-848-9222. Mike, what do you think?
Oh, Christian just stole it from me. I was going to say, new phone, contacts didn't transfer. Who's this?
All right. Well, look, I think I've done that before when I've actually had a new phone. And it does work. People do tell you who it is. So maybe that's the way to go. But then
you just send it right in a text. Hey, my conversation's transferred, but the names didn't. Who is this again?
Well, but then what if I do, because this phone is pretty old, what if I then do get a phone and I actually am in this position? Doesn't it make me look bad?
It won't happen. If you have Android, they transfer automatically. Apple transfers automatically. Everything is backed up and saved and restored, and there's no way it shouldn't unless something freaky happens.
Right, but then won't this person say, well, why didn't your contacts transfer? If you have an Android or
no clue, Apple's trying to figure it out.
Okay. All right. That's the Christian philosophy, not the denomination, but the person. All right. I think part of me actually, Mike, thinks that maybe I should just go forever not knowing who this person is, because
what if it's someone you might actually care about, though?
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Well, I feel like I would have made more effort to save their number if that was the case. But that's a good point. That's a good point. What if this is someone whose number I do actually want to have? That's fair. All right. So far, that's two votes for the Christian approach. Thank you, Mike. 800-848-WABC if you differ or if you want to weigh in. 1-800-848-9222. Nikki is in Manhattan. Hello, Nikki.
Hi, Frank. How are you tonight?
Great. How are you doing?
Pretty good. I think you have a celebrity stalker texting you.
Well, why do you think it's a celebrity?
Well, I mean, you're the celebrity, right?
Oh. Well, that could be.
You know, when he or she said, I got tickets for Chicago, and based on what you say on the radio, I thought you might like this music. Doesn't sound like it's somebody who really knows you.
I think you're right. And because I've never really expressed much of a fondness for Chicago, I don't think I've ever played one of their songs. I mean, I'm sure that I have at some point over the years. So you think this person is a stalker and I should make – and let's say it is a stalker. Does that mean I should make no effort to divine who they actually are.
Well, you could. I mean, you could say, you know, this is hilarious, but who is this? Or if you wanted Rachel to say, you know, this is Rachel, who is this? But I wouldn't keep giving them information about where I'm going to be, et cetera.
Well, that's probably a smart approach, Nikki. That probably makes sense. Thank you. And, you know, it's funny, a former colleague of mine, he texted, "Hi, Frank M., this is Al G." Well, you wouldn't need to tell me. You wouldn't say you wouldn't need to call me Frank M., but I get what he's trying to do. "Hi, Frank M., this is Al G. Just text the person and ask them who they are." So Al is going with the Juliet approach. And Juliet is actually there. I'm curious what she has to say about this. Juliet, my colleague Al, my former colleague, is agreeing with you that I should just come clean and admit I have no idea who this person is. You're sticking with that. Oh, actually, she's not. But we're working on connecting her and patching her in. Pedro is in the Bronx. Hello, Pedro. Pedro, turn your radio off if you would, please.
Yeah, sure. Pretty easy. Just have somebody else call the number. Find out who the hell they are.
All right. Well, but then let's say I gave you the number, Pedro. What are you going to say? Hey, who's this?
No, I'm going to ask him, hey, Frank told me to call you about the situation.
No, but Pedro.
Hey, I want to know.
But Pedro, that's self-defeating. If I'm going to have someone call, that looks makes me look like even more of a jerk than if I just admit that I have no idea who it is.
So I'm thinking of your safety.
Well,
what if this person is a nut?
What if they are a nut? That's true. All right. Well, so at this point, so there seem to be three main options, okay? And thank you for the call, Pedro. The three main options are, one, maintain the status quo. Continue text messaging with this person who I have no idea who they are, who's inviting me to Chicago concerts. Two is come clean. That's the Juliet approach. And that's, you know, that's the Al Gattulo approach. And that's basically admit I have no idea who this person is. Then the third approach is the Christian Mike approach, which is fake that I have a new phone and that my contacts did not transfer over. Those are the three approaches. So status quo, honesty, chicanery. Now, Pedro's throwing a curveball into the honesty approach by saying I should have a third party call. I do like having other people do my dirty work for me. That is, in some respects, very fitting of my personality. But I don't know. Strikes me as a little pretentious, even for me. And I can be pretty pretentious. 800-848-9222. If you have a thought, that's 1-800-848-WABC. We'll continue with your calls in just a moment. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.
Frank Morano, 77-WABC.
With you until 5 o'clock this morning. I got an email here. We're talking about how to respond to my mystery texter. Joan emails me, You are putting this on you. It's his fault or her. Ask him. 800-848-9222. Juliet Huddy is here. Now, Juliet, that is your view as well. You're of the opinion that I should come clean and admit, yes, I have no idea who this person is.
Yes.
What about the Christian approach and the one favored by one of our listeners of saying, oh, I got a new phone, not all my contacts transferred over, our conversation saved, but not your contact?
Why lie?
Right. Well, okay.
Why just not just say this is really ridiculous and I don't know how this happened, but who are you? Because I have been having a fake conversation with you for the last X months or whatever.
Well, I don't think I need to say that. I mean, I could just say that, you know, that I'm not sure who this is, right? I mean, I don't have to say a fake conversation because the conversation is real.
Well, yeah, but it's not really a real conversation if you don't know who you're talking to. Is
well,
it?
You know what?
If a tree falls in the woods.
Well, so many
of my there to witness it.
So many conversations that I actually have in real life seem so fake and fleeting that that who knows? This may fit right in.
I mean, what kind of conversations are you having with this person, though?
Well, they asked me. I lost the text message and I can't look them up because I don't have their name and I don't want to go research it. But basically. They invited me to the Chicago concert,
right,
on Wednesday. I said
so
I couldn't.
It's somebody
make it.
who would think that you liked the band Chicago,
right? Which I really don't. Right. But
so somebody that doesn't know you very.
But
well.
But they were nice. They said, this is what the Wednesday text said. Hey Frank, I know this is very last minute, but I just got two tickets to Chicago at the Beacon Theater tonight at 7:30, and wanted to know if you'd like to join me. From what I hear on your show, you have great taste in music. So, it's that.
Was that the first conversation?
No, the first conversation was May 14th. Hey, Frank, are you going to be at blank today? And I said, no, I'm returning, you know, in a couple of weeks.
Well, what was blank? You can't tell us?
Well, I don't. Here, I'll send you. I'll let you see the.
Well,
the
I, mean, I don't have to, but it's whatever this blank is that you don't want to tell us is connected to this person. So can you just narrow it down that way?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't know if no. So the answer is no, I cannot narrow it down that way. But I think I may just go your route.
Just going to have to.
I was leaning the Christian way, but now, you know, now I'm thinking that your way is the sounder approach.
I mean, honestly, all you have to do at this point, the person listens to the show, so they probably are going to realize.
Well, yeah, I mean, maybe they don't listen to every minute, though. I mean, I am on, as you know, 5.5 hours a day.
Right. I would say that you should probably just give them, honestly, you don't even have to give them an extra line. Just say, hey, who is this? Question mark.
Okay. Well,
boom.
I think that's what I'm going to do. I think that's what I'm going to do.
I think that's a good start.
All right. How was your weekend?
It was nice. It was really good, actually. We went to our friend's live show.
It's your first one post-pandemic, right?
Yes, at the Amityville Music Hall. There was a really great band on before our friend's band. It's called Achilles. They were like almost like a Rage Against the Machine type. They're really good. Really, really good.
So that was Friday or Saturday?
That was Saturday night.
Hmm.
And then I got, there was a gentleman dressed in a black Fred Perry shirt with the yellow or gold kind of insignias, with the buttons buttoned all the way up to the neck. And I went up to him afterwards and I said, are you a Proud Boy? And he said, proud, whatever the line that they say is. And we didn't get into it, but we started chatting much.
So he was a Proud Boy.
It was a Proud Boy. Oh yes.
How did you know? I mean, how do you identify a Proud Boy?
Because he was wearing the Fred Perry shirt, and that's a thing.
Well, what's a Fred Perry shirt?
It's almost like a polo shirt. It's a polo shirt, but it's made by Fred Perry, and they usually wear black, and it has some little kind of gold, you know, like where the polo pony would be. It's a gold something rather.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I just texted this person, so
we'll
see if they write back. I said, I'm not sure if you're listening right now, but who is this? That was my
That's great.
So we'll see.
You probably would have heard of them already, from them already.
You never know with people.
Yeah.
Could be, you know, listening half and back. So we'll see what happens. Well, I'm glad you had fun. I'm glad you and John got to meet a proud boy. And
I don't know if the proud boy was too happy to meet me.
No, it's good. As you always say.
I get interested. I'm interested in talking with people and hearing why. Because he immediately went, "Why, you don't like us?" And I said, "Well, I've had some issues." But, you know, it was a civil conversation. I like talking to people.
Well, that's nice. And then what did you do Sunday?
I basically cooked brunch for my next door neighbor and me because John was at band practice, and that was it.
Hmm.
And then I went to bed.
Well, that sounds like
how was your big bonanza? What
good. Got good weather on Saturday in the Catskills, and then finished ahead at the casino, which is all I can ask.
That's fantastic. What are you going to buy me?
What would you like?
A BMW.
Oh, come on. That's out of my price range, Juliet.
I know Harry Styles tickets.
I could buy you lunch.
Harry Styles tickets.
How much are those?
$1,000.
No, come on. I can do lunch or breakfast.
Okay. That works.
Happily. All right. Well, let me know what you want. We'll coordinate. All right. 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC if you want to comment on anything we're talking about. Hey, one thing that is pretty alarming, and I've been – you know, I do the business reports on the early news with Juliet, and one of the stories that we've been chronicling, and I did mention this Thursday and Friday, are these inflation numbers. Inflation is a very real problem. I don't know if you've noticed this at the gas pump. I don't know if you've noticed this at the grocery store. I certainly have. But interestingly enough, those things aren't even included in the inflation numbers. They omit energy and food, which is great if you never need to power anything or go anywhere or eat anything. But even with the exclusion of food and energy prices, June's jump in consumer prices was the biggest year-over-year increase for any month since 2008. Wow. A surprising 5.4%. A 5.4% jump. You know what's leading the way? Used cars and trucks. I never would have guessed that. But sure enough, used cars and trucks are responsible for one-third of this surge. So I think the Biden administration and his economic team was counting on fleeting inflation, that things would settle back down. Doesn't appear to be the case. It looks like inflation could be long-lasting here. So many of the biggest gains in prices were for goods and services that we all need as the world gets back to normal. Plane tickets through the roof, hotels through the roof. Both Christian and I were just looking at hotel prices for Friday in Atlantic City. It's crazy, crazy. Restaurants through the roof, and cars up significantly. Cars, rental and used, are the biggest culprit. That's accounting for nearly half of the 0.9% increase from May. But there is some evidence that car inflation has peaked. Now, the silver lining here is that price jumps in hospitality, including a 0.7% increase for restaurants, are a result of a rise in wages. So Christian reported that they're bringing in people, workers from Philadelphia, in order to help deal with the labor shortage here. But economists are expecting that inflation will cool in the second half of the year, especially if car prices start to revert back to normal. So we'll see where things go. 800-848-WABC. Let me say hello to Charlie in Hell's Kitchen. Hello, Charlie.
Hello, Frank. Listen, I was saying you should do what Chris and Gabby are saying and just tell the guy you've lost your phone contacts. It's a new port, it's a new phone or something like that, and you need to get their name and number again. You can't come clean and say, look, I've been communicating with you for months, so I have no idea who you are, because then you'll look like a real jerk to them. I mean, think about it from the point of view of the other person whom you're communicating.
Well, that's exactly why I was paralyzed, right? That's exactly why I made no move, because I'm a jerk either way, right? So either I'm a jerk for lying or through the Christian approach, or I'm a jerk for communicating with someone for 2 months that I didn't know. But in any event, it's too late now. We are going to wait and watch as we find out who this person is.
Well, you're never a jerk, Frank. You're a great guy. You just made a stupid mistake. You're a great guy, but you're never a jerk.
Well, Charlie, I know I can be a jerk, believe me. But I don't think I made the mistake. I think the mistake is this person who refuses to sign his name on the text message. Why not just say, hey, this is Charlie. I wanted to know if you're going to be at blank this week. You know, just let me know. Sign your name. That's all I'm asking. 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. We'll do 15 seconds of fame in just a minute. But first, let me say hello to Evelyn in Bayonne. Hello, Evelyn.
Good morning, Frank. Real quickly, thanks very much for Jay and the Americans early in the morning. It really was amazing.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Believe me.
Oh, thank you. The other thing, I wonder why the man doesn't call the show. Why doesn't he call and talk to you directly?
Right. Well, for all I know, perhaps he does. I wouldn't have his phone number saved if that was the case.
Oh, okay. And the other thing about large crowds, I'd love to go see Billy Joel when he opens at the Garden again. But the large crowd thing is holding me back.
So yeah, because of COVID or because of gun violence?
Yeah.
Well, to
definitely.
Which?
And, yes. So just take care of yourself, Frank. Be cautious in
right.
this day and age.
Thank
okay?
you, Evelyn.
Bye.
Thank you. 800-848-9222. I felt like it wasn't worth the effort. I asked the question. She clearly didn't hear. It's going down a rabbit hole. All right. 15 seconds of fame. You want to be heard? Now's your opportunity. Any subject, any thought, anything you want to say, as long as it's 15 seconds or less, say it. All you have to do is dial 1-800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Let's show management what you listeners are capable of. Now's your opportunity. 800-848-9222.
The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
Jealous Guy, 1-800-848-9222. So we end every show by giving you the Vox Populi. This is telephone radio democracy at its finest. We end every show by giving you the Vox Populi. 15 seconds to say whatever you want. 1-800-848-WABC. Now, it only works if people actually call. If people don't call, then it becomes a pretty lame segment. If it's the guy who calls and says, Sid's a moron, and E. Frank, then ultimately it becomes, you know, pretty repetitive and boring. So we'll keep doing it as long as you keep having interest. So if you want this segment to continue, call in now and say something interesting or entertaining or fun. 1-800-848-WABC, because it's time for
The Other Side of Midnight. This is 15 Seconds of Fame.
Oh, that's right. 15 seconds to say whatever you like. 1-800-848-9222. Larry is in Brooklyn. Hello, Larry.
Yes, I just want to say Sid Rosenberg is not a moron. Sid Rosenberg is not a moron. The caller who calls in and says Sid Rosenberg is a moron, he's a moron.
Well said. 800-848-9222. Ed in Nyack. Hello.
Hey, Frank, I heard when you went to Cape May, you really stepped in it. Maybe when you go to Frantic City, you'll step into some pretty big wampum.
Well done. 800-848-9222. Robert in Manhattan.
Hello. I have a 50-year-old book by Long John Nebo about flying saucers. I'd like to lend it to you.
Well, I don't want to borrow it because I don't know when I'll get around to reading it. If you want to give it to me, I'll take it, but I'm not going to borrow it. Thank you, just the same. Maybe I'll just buy it used online. 800-848-WABC. Sal is in Brooklyn.
Hey, how you doing? Not only is the inflation with the gas prices are up, there's a gas shortage. The last time we ran out of gas like this is when Juliet Hoodie's exes had to fill up the moving vans.
Oh, stop. 1-800-848-WABC. Kathy is in Brooklyn. Hello.
Hi, good morning. I just want to say Curtis Sliwa for mayor. We need him to save our precious city.
Thank you, Kathy. 800-848-9222. Mark is in New Jersey.
Yeah, the better version of Jealous Guys by Brian Ferry. And true Americans are awake, not awoke. Thank you.
Jimmy in the Bronx. Hello.
She's a moron. She's a moron.
E. Frank in Astoria. Hello.
Yes, I have a question, and it's not like the Romulans from Star Trek. I want to know when the federal government are going to save our butts here in New York City where all this violence going on.
800-848-WABC. Roscoe is in New York.
Kallstrom covered up Flight 800, and he did the same thing for the murders at Waco. Thanks.
Thank you. Isn't it? That's Russell. Sounds suspiciously like Russell. 800-848-WABC. As we wrap up here this Monday morning, Tom is in Deegan. Hello, Tom.
Hey, how you doing? Last we spoke, we talked about The Godfather, and before that, it was about restaurants. I went to a great place called Bella Luna, 88th in Columbus. Just check it out if you don't know it.
I am not familiar with it, but it makes sense to end with
a long time.
Thank you, Tom. I'll check it out. It makes sense to end with a good restaurant recommendation. So we'll wrap up this edition of 15 Seconds of Fame. Stay tuned, though, to the WABC early news, because there is a lot of news with respect to what is happening in the mayor's race, what's happening with respect to gun violence in this city, what's happening in the world of sports. I mean, you want to talk about a textbook New York Met weekend? That is what we saw from the New York Mets this weekend. From blowing that lead and costing me $190 on Saturday to Rojas getting ejected to Jacob DeGrom getting hurt. I mean, it's just a Met weekend all around, that is for sure. All right, and I'll bring you – Sid will have sports. Juliet and I will bring you some headlines. Juliet's got the weather as well, so you'll know whether or not you're going to need an umbrella today. And I will update you tomorrow. Sometimes people complain that I don't update them on things. I will update you tomorrow on the response to that mystery texter. We'll see what they – say, if anything. And it looks like I am not going to be able to do Atlantic City Friday, at least not an overnight stay. Maybe I'll do a day trip to Bethlehem, because I got to keep this $1,500 minimum of weekly winnings moving. I got to keep going in the right direction. And this way, maybe I could see my Aunt Madeline if I go to Bethlehem. So we'll see where that goes. All right, the WABC Early News is next. You want to email me, you can do so by doing frank.morano. That's frank.morano at wabcradio.com. That's frank.morano at wabcradio.com. That about slams the lid on this portion of the show for today. But don't go anywhere, because there's 90 minutes of news coming your way. Joe Nolan's got traffic. Sid Rosenberg has got sports. Juliet and I have a bunch of breaking news stories. But first, Deb Valentine has 77 seconds of news coming your way. To be continued.